Wellness. Thank you all for coming. I think most of my committee is coming this morning, but maybe they couldn't find us. I'm not sure. But Representative Maurer will not be here, and I know Representative Olson will be late. The others should be coming in ere long. So we're going to be opening up an informational hearing on psychotropic medications and foster children development. The Interim Assistant Director of the Children, Adults, and Family Division, Erin.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, Representative Cortez. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal, and I'm the Interim Director of the DHS Children, Adults, and Families Division. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. As you can tell from the agenda, you'll be seeing quite a bit of me. But hopefully, mostly you'll be hearing from the experts in our division on the topics that you've requested some information about. And what I provided also, just for context, and would call your attention to that I may be referring to now and again to some of my remarks, is this fact sheet that we provided that includes data from our 2007 Status of Children in the Child Protective Service System. We publish data based on the federal fiscal year, which is why this is complete through 2007. And I thought it would be helpful just to have some information in front of you today specifically about our child welfare programs, because much of what we're discussing today relates to them, but also just would remind the committee that in the Children, Adults, and Families Division, we're part of really two big continuums. One is the continuum of child safety, and that includes for us both our self-sufficiency programs that play a preventive and early intervention role with families around child safety and health and wellness for families, as well as economic stability for families. And also then the child safety issue more broadly with our child welfare program, which includes keeping kids safe at home where possible, and also then keeping them safe in foster care if that's necessary. So we have a broad scope within the Children, Adults, and Families Division of responsibility, and you'll be hearing a little bit more about that today, and specifically you'll be hearing quite a bit about our kids in foster care and our child welfare program area. So I thought this information might be helpful. Just to frame a bit the first topic on the agenda around psychotropic medications and foster children, this issue, I think, came...
Stop you just for a second. So you're talking about the status of children, that's back to the 2007. Is that what you're referring to, or the brief history?
Chair Tomei, what I just was referring to was the FAST fact sheet.
You know, I got this off my email. Do other people have this? Does anybody... Representative Gillian, thank you so much for joining.
My pleasure.
Do you have this also? You don't?
I do.
Great. Perfect. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so I'll refer to this as the FAST fact sheet now and again, but mostly I'll just be referring to some of the numbers that it includes, and I thought this would be a nice reference document for the committee to have. But moving more specifically into the issue of psychotropic medications, one of our goals in child welfare is to ensure the safety and the health of children who are in foster care. It's incumbent upon us when a child cannot be at home safely with their family and they come into an out-of-home placement, I believe, to make sure that they are safe first and foremost, and also that their health care needs are met. And behavioral health care is a significant part of meeting a child's health care needs. I think it's important to think about this issue of psychotropic medications within the broader effort to ensure the health of children in foster care. And in February, I know that you heard a review of a draft report specifically on the prescribing practice for kids in foster care. And what you heard there is that it's often the case that children in child welfare are prescribed psychotropic medications at higher rates than children in the general population. And the information that was used for comparison in that particular report, which all of you now have a final copy of, was compared against just a subset of the general child population within the Oregon Health Plan. Today, what our goal is in this presentation is to update you on the actions that the Children, Adults, and Families Division has taken so far to implement the work group's recommendations on this issue. And as part of that, there are really two overarching goals. One is to ensure that children in foster care have their mental health needs met appropriately. And as part of that, as a subset of that, it's to be sure that the prescription that the prescribing practices that are happening with respect to our kids are appropriate and that kids are safe. I think that one of the contextual pieces of information that is helpful to have thinking about this issue before I turn it over to Terry and to Kevin is that the trends in children's health are really changing. One of the things that has happened over the last several years as we've looked nationally at children's health care data is that children are less and less suffering from more acute kinds of illnesses, respiratory infections, things that can be dealt with quickly and addressed through often sometimes medication or treatment. And instead, more children are struggling with chronic conditions that require either a prolonged period of intervention and sometimes even a lifetime of intervention. And specifically with mental health issues, there was a 2003 national survey of children's health that showed that there's been a 20% increase in diagnosable mental health challenges for children today nationwide. And the reason that I bring this up is that I think it's important to keep in mind that this issue around children in foster care being prescribed psychotropic medicines more often than children in the general population is not unique to Oregon. And the challenges that our healthcare system is facing with respect to appropriate treatment for children who are struggling with behavioral health challenges is also not unique to Oregon. And so what I think this says to us as a state is that it's incumbent upon us to think differently about how we approach this issue and how we organize our ability to review, monitor, and keep children safe in our care who are facing behavioral health challenges, because the issues for kids with respect to health are changing. I'm just going to stop there and turn it over, as I said, to the experts who are going to do an overview for you of what actions we've taken to date with respect to the report you heard about earlier this year, and at the end I'll do a quick summary of where I think we are and where we're trying to go. So,
good morning, Chairman Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Terry Schultz. I'm a registered nurse with the Department of Human Services Child Welfare. I have had 15 years of experience with pediatrics and 10 years of experience with pediatric mental health issues and psychopharmacology. My work with child welfare began in 1997, and since that time, I have seen an increase in the acuity of needs of the children in our care, both physically and mental health issues. I have seen an increase in the numbers of children with multiple mental health diagnoses, as well as an increase in the prescriptive practice of polypharmacology. In 2005, a work group was formed in Multnomah County with the charge of looking at the psychotropic medication policy of DHS. As a member of that original committee in Multnomah, I was responsible for developing training on psychotropic medication management, as well as integrating information from the work group's recommendations into policy revision. Those revisions were completed, and the new psychotropic medication policy was effective in May 2007. I was also a member of the DHS work group on medication management, which convened in November of 2007 to look at department-wide issues surrounding psychotropic medications. The initial charge of that committee was to look at the psychotropic medication policy and practice within the child welfare system. The work of that committee is reflected in the report on psychotropic medications for foster children dated 2008, which I believe that you all have a copy of that list distributed earlier this year. Currently, I am a member of the newly formed Child Welfare Medical Advisory Committee, which started their work in June of this year. The work of that committee is primarily to explore and expand on recommendations that are included in that report on the psychotropic medications for foster children. Other components of my work include providing medical consultation to DHS staff, contracted registered nurses, and foster parents on a wide variety of medical and mental health issues. I also assist workers with case planning and provision of services and negotiating the sometimes complex world of medicine and healthcare. I also provide training on policy and practice of psychotropic medication management, which has been presented to foster parents, DHS caseworkers, supervisors, and various other community partners. Over the past 4 years, I have presented training in 18 counties across the state of Oregon with approximately 800 participants. This training includes not only policy and procedure, but also medication-specific information to be used by foster parents to effectively manage the day-to-day administration of medications and also monitoring these children. In this training, I stress that psychotropic medications are only part of the equation in treating children with mental health or behavioral issues. It is also our responsibility to provide the supports and services that are needed to help heal the emotional wounds that may be causing some or all of the symptoms that we're seeing in these children. One of my responsibilities that started in May of last year was providing review and recommendations for psychotropic medications. As part of the revised policy of 2007, if a child meets certain review criteria, a review must be done at the central office level. The review criteria is as follows. A child is under the age of 6. A child is receiving more than 3 psychotropic medications at any one time. A child is receiving 2 medications in any one medication category, such as 2 stimulants, 2 antidepressants, 2 antipsychotics, and so forth. A child is on a PRN or an as-needed medication, or a child is receiving a PRN or as-needed medication 2 times in any 7-day period. Any of that review criteria automatically is sent as a review and recommendation profile to my office. The review that is done in central office includes looking at the prescribed dosages of the medications, any possible drug interactions, contraindications for the medications, and diagnoses which are being treated. After I've completed the review, recommendations are made to the caseworker to either seek a second opinion or request clarifying information from the prescriber. In 2005, when the Multnomah County Medication Work Group was formed, one of the first questions that was asked by the Multnomah County Juvenile Court judges was, what are the statistics? How many children in state custody are taking medications? How many children are on multiple medications? And how young are the children that are being prescribed medications? How young are those children that we have in care? We were able to gather those statistics that showed in May of 2007 approximately 29% of children in foster care were prescribed psychotropic medications, with 19% being prescribed 3 or more psychotropic medications. And at that time, there were 69 children under the age of 4 that were being prescribed psychotropic medications. Our current data, compiled in May of 2008, showed 28% of children were prescribed psychotropic medication, 11% were prescribed 3 or more medications, and there were 65 children in our care under the age of 4 that were being prescribed psychotropic medications. Psychopharmacology is receiving local and national attention, with hearings being held in May of this year in Washington, D.C. The testimony provided there by national experts confirmed the fact that the increase in psychopharmacology, especially polypharmacology, is a national issue. Dr. Laura Leslie, who is a developmental behavioral pediatrician at Tufts University, reported nearly half of all children in foster care have chronic medical conditions. About half the children 0 to 5 years have significant developmental delays, and up to 80% of all children in foster care have serious emotional problems. Dr. Zito with the University of Maryland stated, among community-based populations, foster care youth tend to receive psychotropic medications as much or more than disabled youth and 3 to 4 times the rate among children with Medicaid coverage that are not in the foster care system. In conclusion, I would like to thank the committee for hearing this important information and would like to stress the importance of understanding that psychotropic medications can be paramount in helping a child manage their mental health issues and maximize their capabilities of becoming a successful and contributing member of the community. Psychotropic medication should be recognized as an appropriate and effective part of the treatment plan for some children. It is critical, however, that these children receive thorough evaluations and comprehensive treatment that address all aspects of the child's physical, mental, developmental, educational, and behavioral health. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think we're going to wait for questions until we welcome
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Kevin George, and I work as the Foster Care Program Manager at the Department of Human Services, and I appreciate having this time to talk with you today. And my part is to really talk about where we are with the DHS Medication Management Work Group as far as the report and following up on the recommendations. So as Ms. Schultz talked about a little bit of the history, kind of why are we here now, again, it's important to keep in context that the psychotropic medication is something that actually ended up in statute in Oregon in the mid-90s. So it's not just a 2 or 3 year phenomenon that's happening now. It actually started mid-1990s for Oregon, and many other states are now just starting to look at legislation, different things that are going on as a result of that. But as Ms. Schultz said, then, really, it started coming out of the judicial bench in the Multnomah County, seeing more and more kids on it, started asking those questions, kind of what is next. And so the work group really in the Multnomah County area, it consisted of department staff, judicial staff, CASA programs, juvenile rights project staff, a number of folks, including foster parents, and started talking about what is the issue and where do we go with this. So those recommendations, for the most part, were incorporated in the policy that went into effect in May of 2007, which is still what we're operating under. The handout, then, that we provided you actually starts with a brief history. And so that's the piece I'm just going to reference here and walk you through that part of it. But it really then started last fall with the director of Human Services, Dr. Goldberg, then putting this work group together to start on the work group report. And so that's where I'm going to take us to next, in terms of next steps. I identified a couple of data trends for you there, and Ms. Schultz talked about some of the data that you hear about. One of the things also that the question was, when we start looking at all of, and this committee's had information on foster care before, when we talk about all of the kids in out-of-home care, that includes children in a family foster home, that includes children with a relative foster care, that includes children in a residential treatment in a psychiatric hospital, the whole gamut. And so part of our question is to say, let's hone in on some of the more specific issues. So as we take some of that larger numbers of the 28% of children in out-of-home care on psychotropic medications and say, give me that number on just those children in family foster care or relative care. And so what I provided you there, and I'm going to pause for a moment. This mic seems to be cutting in and out, and I don't know if it's on my end or your end. And I can keep going, but as long as you can hear it, that's fine. Okay, I'll keep going.
While we're stopped, I forgot to remind you, please turn off your cell phones and your Blackberries and pagers and that kind of thing. It really does affect the recording system.
Thank you. So, Chair Tomei, then where I'm at as far as on the data trends, so as we talk about those children, specifically in relative care or regular foster care, the prescribing medication then is 20.9% of the children. And so that number is different than when we look at the same number of kids in relative and family foster care in 2007, which was 21.9%. So we've seen a 4.9% decrease in the last year when we compare apples to apples, the same numbers of kids, the same kind of kids with the same other group here. So as you can see, then, the number we're talking about is of the 6,283 children in foster care in May, 1,311 of them had a prescription in the prior 12 months of care.
So was that prescription just for psychotropics? Is that
correct?
What you're talking?
Correct. And so we then pull the same kind of number for the children in regular and relative care for under age of four, and you see the numbers there as well. 65 children under the age of four have had a psychotropic prescription in the last 12 months. The data folks, as well as Ms. Schultz in the medical world, wants to always have me underline, which is why there's a little note there, that when we pull in data, it's really talking about this is what is. It does not go in to try to explain, should it have been. All they're providing is data. So they're not able from data systems to say, was the physician correct in prescribing this or not? That's not what these numbers mean. So it's important to keep that clarification, and our research staff will be happy that I brought that up. So as I walk through then the different findings in the DHS medication work group report, each of the bulleted items is actually what the recommendation was and what our action is at this time. And so I won't go into laboriously go through each and every one of those because you have that in front of you, but hit a couple of the highlights. And so in part it talks about developing health-related expertise regionally and dealing with complex medical issues, behavioral issues, and related mental health or physical health concerns in child welfare. And when folks have asked, what do we do about the medical department now, we not jokingly refer to is our medical department is Ms. Schultz at this point in time. So she's our medical expertise on our staff at this point in time and provides most of the support to staff out in the field. We have been working on looking at our existing resources within the department and are there other ways of pulling in other support, and we've received a lot of support and help from the Division of Medical Assistance Program and some of the expertise of Dr. Kitchens and Dr. Schaefer as two examples of that, trying to bring some more expertise to us, as well as in the process of developing a policy option package for next session around how do we develop more medical support and an infrastructure for child welfare specifically. And you'll see more of that as the fall and certainly session begins. The next piece is really looking at the specialized case management loads for kids with complex medical care. And again, the department's through the transformation initiative completed a staffing study of which there's been some information. There'll be certainly more in session talking about how do we start dealing with specialized caseloads or the workload of the actual caseworkers who are actually doing the work for the kids and the families at this point in time. I'm going to go down into talking about the hiring or contract with the physician. That's one of the recommendations that came out of the work group. And again, that goes into the whole structure, developing an infrastructure within child welfare about how could we or how can we actually utilize existing resources or find additional resources to bring in a medical director to help with the oversight of a medical program. And so we're exploring what we can do there, either on a part-time, short-term, and also looking at the long-term needs of what our program really needs to have overall. So within that, that's part of the policy option package we've been developing as far as a medical program infrastructure. The next piece is probably one that there's more substantial work occurring on right now, and it's a recommendation that was to really kind of pick up where the original DHS work group left off and provide more of the strategic planning, kind of the next steps on some of the issues. Again, keeping in context that the work group that Dr. Schaefer actually chaired, and he's not the only member, and the report lists all the members. I want to give them credit because they did a lot of work. They had a window of time of 60 to 90 days to get all that information and make some findings and recommendations. So they were on a time-limited scope, and so part of the recommendation was to develop a further group to do more of the strategic planning and vet more of the issues out in a much more thorough process. And so that group now is called the Child Welfare Medical Advisory Committee for Child Welfare. And we just formed, Ms. Schultz talked about that, just formed in June. And we've had two meetings. We have another one in 2 weeks from now. And we're trying to go down the work group reports to say, so what was the first recommendation? One of the recommendations that came out of that was to really talk about the review thresholds. And as Ms. Schultz talked about, is looking at reviewing children under age six, is that a review criteria? What is the basis for that? What is the review criteria for three medications? Why not two medications? Why not four? What is the basis for that? And so as we talked about that and grappled with that, one of the recommendations came out of our group was to say we need to take this to that where the expert base is, and that expert base is the Drug Use Review Board, and we are submitting that request to them, and they're doing the research on this now from national data and whatnot to say, really, is 3 the right number? Is under age 6 the right number? Or are there other things that they would come back to us and provide recommendation on, as well as just prescribing medication for children in general? You know, foster children, as we talked about, are getting the national attention right now. But when you look at the overall data, it's children in general around prescribing medications and the health needs of children that have changed dramatically over the last several years. The second issue, then, that we've really discussed with the Medical Advisory Committee is one of the other recommendations in terms of the infrastructure. As we start developing a policy option package, we talk about, well, we need that medical expertise in every county and every branch, and how do we get there? And really, one of the nice things about having a cross-section of folks on the Medical Advisory Committee is they talk about different ways of getting there. And really, with the medical community, having panels of physicians or panels of nurses that you can bring in, then a cross-section of folks with expertise in both pediatric care, mental health care, and whatnot, then you may actually have a more rich medical community in order to provide us a consultation device. So as we're looking at policy option packages, we're taking that information from that group to say, here's what we might be able to do in a more potentially cost-effective manner, as well as being able to locate nurses in rural communities, which we already struggle with in many other parts of the department. And the next one the review committee is working on is consent. And who is approving consent for medications for children, and where does this fall in lines of legal authority, parent authority, practice, facing the reality of how to get some of this stuff done. So we're working on that one next. The other piece is then that the overall work group report talks about is establishing a behavioral health review committee. We have not pursued that one yet, kind of waiting to get some of these other things, which we determined was more pressing to get decisions on as far as the review thresholds and some of the other structural things in first. The other ones, then, if you look at talking about recommendations, making sure that policies and procedures are that all children are receiving the appropriate services that they need at the right time, at the right dosage, if that's what it is, or at the right service level, meaning that are they receiving actual mental health services and counseling in addition to the medication or in lieu of as a way of getting there. So a comprehensive plan for children in foster care. And we're working with the mental health division on that piece. The next piece in it, a recommendation, and they had a lot of recommendations in that report. The next recommendation was really about the data information systems and knowing that there's child welfare data. There's data that's within the Department for Medical Assistance Programs, and that is what physicians, what pharmacies actually bill the department for Medicaid services. And so some of it is trying to get those data systems actually talk. So when we pull out information, it's the same information that's coming out of those systems. Within child welfare, though, we've been working the last several months on enhancing our current information system, and you'll hear folks in the field talk to it as refer to it as FACES, and that's basically the computerized case plan. And so FACES is an acronym that I shouldn't have said until I knew what it meant. It's like Family and Child Information System. Of that. So FACES is the acronym for that overall system, but it's the electronic case file that caseworkers then put information into. So we're working with the Division of Medical Assistance Program, make sure we get information out of their system that can actually go into FACES. And so as caseworkers then are able to bring up and keep their case records updated with children's medical care and medical history, then we're able to also then provide that to the courts. Our hope is that system will actually be up and running by December of this year, and we've seen some good results thus far as some of the work that they've been designing and working on. And that will include medication management in that system as well. And then the last piece as far as recommendation was the overall looking at providing training, some policy and direction, and we're clearly continuing to work on that with Michelle's doing trainings. There's also other folks starting to enter into the world of training, and so there's some training that's occurring down in Medford next week, a week after, on psychotropic medications, and some experts are coming in to talk about that. So it's starting to really kind of gain some momentum around building a better capacity so we actually can get training out there for a lot of other folks. And then as far as the piloting projects, that's another recommendation that we have not taken any action on yet. Again, trying to take on what's the most pressing issues, at least by our determination. The last couple of things I would say then is that there's other related actions that the department is working on that actually that impacts this to some degree when you start looking at how these things actually move out. And it is around revisiting our family-based services contracts and looking at how do we actually provide services in the family? How do we keep children at home first and foremost? How do we get kids back home after they come into care and making sure that they're actually getting the right services there? So if they are back home, then they are still getting mental health services and getting what their needs are met. And then some of the things within the foster care system, clearly we've tried to restructure our entire training program this last biennium and have been successful working with Portland State University and restructuring that so we have more training for foster parents. But we have to look at the long term being able to sustain that. And so we have a policy option package that we're working on right now, talking about how do we sustain that practice of including medication management in that. And then a rate redesign, which is really the foster parents' reimbursement system, and how do we actually make sure that the appropriate services are there for the foster parents, that they're actually supporting the kids' needs primarily is what they need to happen. So those are other things that are happening that relate to this, directly or indirectly, but it's things that are occurring within the department at this point in time.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, if I could just summarize at a high level where we're trying to go with this. Our priority is to optimize the health and behavioral health of kids in our care. And we're part of our strategy is to improve the quality of their mental health care, and part of that strategy is to ensure the safety of foster children who are prescribed medications. And the way that we're approaching that issue specifically at a high level, Kevin just went into a lot of detail, is as follows. We're going to have better data to drive our decision-making. We have stronger, clearer policies. We have more oversight, review, and monitoring. We have more training for caseworkers and foster parents. And ultimately, this is part of a bigger strategy of coordination, which the Child Welfare Division is actively engaged in, so that we can be sure that we have good assessment and screening for kids who are coming into care and determine which children actually need to have behavioral health services early and in a timely way so that we can optimize their health situation. And also then when those services are needed, we can coordinate with our partner organizations that provide the services in a better way. And this relates directly to the governor's wraparound initiative, and we are fully engaged and supportive of that and are moving forward to implement it within child welfare. So for us, this is part of a bigger set of strategies designed to focus on meeting our foster kids' behavioral health needs in a better way, and we really appreciate the time today to share with you specifically on the issue of psychotropic prescribing some of the actions that we've taken to date.
Thank you. Any questions? Welcome. Not very much. How about 5 more minutes, and I know that doesn't get too much time at all, and I know there are lots of questions. And we could ask questions that we can get email answers to.
I'll try to be short. Well, first of all, thank you for being here, and thank you to the chair for putting this on the agenda. It's an important topic, and I think you've made some progress. I still have some concerns about the speed at which some of this is happening. So I guess the question I would like to get on the record is the timeline on some of these issues. For example, reviewing the criteria when you evaluate a case. I have concerns. 6 or under, 3 or is it 3 or 4 or more? More than 3. So if you have 3 drugs, you might not be reviewed, but if you have 4, you do.
Unless you're under 6.
Unless you're under 6. So I think, those kind of things. What's your timeline for making some changes?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, the timeline is actually the Drug Use Review Board. I have to make sure I don't use acronyms all the time. The Drug Use Review Board is actually reviewing this information on September 18th. And we hope to have some recommendations and findings back from them at that point in time, and then we'll make some decisions on where we go next. I think it's important to also know, though, that as a physician is prescribing the medications, they, too, are to be taken into consideration other medications the kids are on. So it's not as though folks are just prescribing and then waiting for a magic 3 or 4 number to hit before anybody else looks at it. So I want to make sure we have an understanding of that.
Thank you, Chair. The prescribing issue, you know, having read the report, one of the questions I had was, one of the concerns I just want to point out through page 12 on that report, where it talks about the number of children in foster care compared to also non-foster care children and how often they've had a mental health assessment within 60 days of taking up the class prescription. That's less than half. And I do think one of the things that's missing in this conversation, I see Dr. Schaefer back there, and I know DVAP, Vision Medical Assistance Program, has been involved. I would like to see some speedier look at what our mental health providers are doing to meet their obligations, repay them, see these kids, many of whom are on the health plan, they're not getting the mental health assessments. Who are the prescribers? Why are they not getting assessed? That's something I'm not hearing and would like to see some more.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotick, in briefly to respond, we have a separate report on that issue. It's something that we are looking at seriously. We have data about and are making some changes to our own internal process to make sure that we can increase the number of kids who are getting assessed in a timely way and actually begin to shorten the timelines for assessment. Today, our requirement and rule is that a child receive an assessment within 60 days. We're trying to take some steps to shorten that length of time. We didn't go into detail on that today because there's almost too much information just on the psychotropic medication issue, but we'd be happy to provide you with some follow-up information about some of the activity we have ongoing on that issue.
Thank you. Can I have some interest also in knowing you don't need to provide it today, but maybe you can send us information by email about children when they leave foster care? Are they still on medication? That's one question. And if so, how are they followed up? And if the department's still involved with them. The other is, we're talking about children in foster care. So are there children that department might be involved with who are still at home, who are also on psychotropic medication? And if so, how are they followed up? So I really appreciate this. You gave us a lot of information, and you sent us a lot of information by email, too. And I think it takes us a while to observe this. This is obviously an issue that the committee is very concerned about, and we'll be following up in the future. And I'm just amazed that there's one person in Salem that is following up on all of this and acting as a consultant, I would assume. And obviously that's an issue that we need to address here as one person. Thank you so much, and we'll be hearing from you again.
So, I don't think I called
you. Would you prefer if we send questions to Rick, who can then put them all together and send them to the department, and then we get responses back to the committee? How would that be? I might have several, but I just want to make sure that's true.
Chair Tomei. May I also add one additional piece of follow-up that we will be providing to the committee for the on the record? I apologize, I neglected to mention this before we wrap that piece up. There's some data and information in the report about that looks at the variable of race and ethnicity against the data around prescribing. And the department has been looking into this particular set of data quite extensively and realized, unfortunately, after the report went out, that there's some cleanup that needs to happen with respect to that data. We are hoping to be able to provide you an update of that data and information and the conclusions from which you can draw from it within the next 8 weeks. So we talked to our data analyst and believe it's going to take us that amount of time to begin to dig a little deeper. Some of this has to do with the way we share data and information, which is part of the improvement effort that's underway internally within the organization. Some of it has to do with how we ask questions, even among ourselves. So we appreciate your patience with that, and I did just want to point out for the committee on the record that we will be providing an update with that data that will look a little different, and then we'd be happy to answer any questions about that when you get that update.
Thank you very much.
So we'll do an update on you can just stay right there, Aaron, for the rest of the day. Intensive treatment and recovery services for parents of children in child welfare system. Aaron and John Pearson and Karen Freeman. Thank you. And you're from the street?
members of the committee, in the interest of time, as my colleagues seat themselves, I will start quickly and be brief with an overview. The reason that I wanted to share some information for you on this topic is because the issue of addictions as it relates to our foster care system is one of our most critical issues. And again, I want to thank the committee for giving us some attention on this issue today. Just some additional statistical information, some of which is on that FAST fact sheet that you have. In 2007, for nearly 40% of our child abuse victims, drug and alcohol abuse was the largest single family problem. And for nearly 55% of kids entering foster care, drug and alcohol abuse was a primary factor. In 4 of the 12 child fatalities in 2007, alcohol or other drugs was a factor. And I think what these data points illustrate is that are really two things. One, the issue around addiction affects the safety of kids and the rate at which they are coming into our child welfare system. And also, what's a dynamic that's important to keep in mind is that the issue of addiction affects our ability within the child welfare system to return a child safely to their home, to their parents. In 2007, the legislature understood this issue very well and appropriated over $10 million in targeted addiction intervention treatment services that will benefit specifically Oregon children and their families who are either at risk of entering or who are in the child welfare system. And that's what we're here to provide you an update on today. The investments importantly focused on key outcomes for child welfare, and this is something that I think is unique and the legislature deserves credit for. We invested in addiction services and are asking our addictions providers to keep track of our ability within the child welfare system or to work with us on our ability in the child welfare system to reduce the amount of time a child spends in foster care and to increase the number of families in our system with addiction issues who are reunified. So it's our effort to really marry and make sure that we are jointly sharing responsibility for the connection between the investment in addiction treatment that is targeted and also the impact it has on the children and families that are in our child welfare system or who are at risk of entering it. So our goal today is just to review to date the work that's been done with respect to that investment and also to thank you again for making it.
Chairman May, members of the committee, I'm Bob Nickel. I'm the Assistant Director in the Department of Human Services responsible for addictions in the Mental Health Division. I too want to echo and thank the legislature for the allocation of the about $10.6 million. It was the single largest new initiative that we had in our division, and I want to really express my appreciation for the recognition that this is a major issue. Frankly, we need far more, but it's really great to get a start with this, and we want to demonstrate that we can do this and show you some results. I'll get off the stage here really quickly. I do want to say that this is one of the key cross-divisional initiatives. Aaron and I have been talking about this. If I could just take the liberty of adding that on the previous topic, we've also enlisted Dr. Nancy Winters, who is my child an adolescent medical director for addictions and mental health, and we're sharing her functions with CAF so that we truly have a cross-divisional representation here. And Dr. Nancy Winters is on the faculty at the medical school, Department of Psychiatry, is a great resource and is adding a lot to both of these initiatives, particularly the mental health initiative. We've allocated now the funding throughout the counties in Oregon. They're getting a good start on it. The latest data that I have show that approximately 650 parents have been referred by the CAF field offices. And about 375 of those parents are now already enrolled in treatment programs supported by the funding. So I will turn it over to Karen Wheeler for more detail from the addictions and mental health perspective. Karen is the addictions policy administrator for Oregon.
Thank you, Bob. And Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addictions Policy Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division, Department of Human Services, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to testify and provide you with information today about the Intensive Treatment and Recovery Services Initiative. And we refer to it as ITRS. I'll try to go back and forth with acronyms. I'm not used to many acronyms as well. The Intensive Treatment and Recovery Services Initiative was designed with two key concepts in mind. first of all, that addiction is a chronic relapsing brain disease requiring lifelong management and support and an array of services for families and individuals. It's not an acute issue. And then secondly, as with other chronic conditions like diabetes, asthma, heart disease, hypertension, the path to stabilization and recovery includes treatment for acute symptoms, but also ongoing self-care and peer supports provided during periods of stability, and additional peer supports and possibly treatment again during periods of relapse. And I'd like to say that the seed was really planted for this initiative by then-Director Brian Johnston, Director of the Department of Human Services, in 2005. Brian asked me to chair the DHS methamphetamine response team in 2005. And so I took this challenge, and we brought together a group of people from the department, from various divisions, including CAF, AMH, Public Health, and other parts of the department. And what we started doing, first of all, was analyzing data sets and comparing data, because what Brian's charge to us was is find out how methamphetamine is really impacting the department, because there was a lot of attention around methamphetamine in the media at that time, and there has been, continues to be. So basically, our analysis led us to the conclusion that there was a large treatment gap for parents involved in the child welfare system who have lost custody of their children and who are at risk of losing their parental rights, and that this treatment gap was growing. This has a major impact, as you already know, on the foster care system. It also has an economic impact on the state's budget for foster care. And as you heard earlier, it has an economic impact for the cost of medications. When children don't have healthy attachments with their parents cannot take care of their children, it definitely causes some emotional problems for children as well. So this we pulled together a report, and a lot of it was data that was used during the 07 session when we were talking about this ITRS initiative and making the case that we needed more treatment to close this gap. From 2000 to 2005, the treatment gap widened for parents. That gap, I am happy to say, has narrowed since 2005, in part because of two things that have happened. Our system really has taken the call to action to treat more people involved in the child welfare system. So we have more effectively utilized treatment capacity for this population. In addition, during the 05 session, you enacted legislation that removed pseudoephedrine, the key ingredient required to manufacture methamphetamine in home labs, from the market, and that now requires a doctor's prescription. So there are fewer home labs and fewer children taken out of those homes, which is a great thing. However, people are still finding methamphetamine. It is still coming from the borders, our border states, as well as other countries. But the great thing is the labs have reduced almost to zero. Responding to the need for increased treatment, you enacted legislation and provided us with a budget to implement the ITRS initiative. And I really want to emphasize that the ITRS initiative is a systems change project as well as a capacity expansion initiative. We, AMH, is working with CAF, and I would echo what Bob and Aaron talked about. This is a really strong collaborative between AMH and CAF. We're working together to really move a system change agenda related to serving addicted parents in the child welfare system. The cross-divisional collaboration between AMH and CAF serves as a model to local implementation teams, because we want to model that partnership and collaboration for the local teams of the mental health directors, the treatment providers, and the CAF managers and caseworkers, because we want that to happen locally as well. A recovery-oriented system for ITRS families is based on the following elements: healing and rebuilding for parents and families, a holistic approach to services with effective transitions between levels of service and care, use of evidence-based interventions and models, integration of recovery support services, such as peer-to-peer mentoring and recovery housing with traditional treatment services, collaboration with early childhood partners and service providers, and collaborative case planning with CAF local partners. And now I'm just going to basically list off some of the actions that we have taken to date to implement this initiative. We issued a request for plan amendment to the community mental health programs shortly after the session ended. We required them to respond in their application by talking about how they were going to implement a recovery-oriented system of care for parents for these families and how they were going to use an evidence-based service delivery model. And we did provide two and promoted two examples of such models. We developed a funding distribution formula for the intensive outpatient treatment component and the residential bed component of this initiative. And we vetted that thoroughly with the community mental health program directors, with CAF, and the addiction treatment providers. We developed new contract language to include system outcomes and performance measurements specific to this initiative, as Aaron mentioned. We built in the contracts the requirement to increase parent-child reunification, reduce length of stay in foster care, retention of treatment for at least 90 days, and that particular time is associated with positive clinical outcomes and societal outcomes. And we also built in utilization requirements so that each county had to serve a certain minimum number of people under this initiative. We also, with CAF, developed a standardized referral process for all CAF clients referred for alcohol and drug assessments. And this process really emphasizes strengths as well as barriers to treatment and gaps that may exist within that family. CAF modified its data system to track referrals to addiction service providers. And our research units also worked very closely together to ensure that we can match data down to the individual client level so that we can determine that these outcomes are being met and that the clients are progressing as they receive these services. With CAF, we have conducted 21 visits out of the 36 community mental health program regions to monitor local implementation of this initiative. These visits include, they not only include CAF child welfare managers, but self-sufficiency staff and management, treatment providers, early childhood system partners, and mental health directors. And as well, AMH and CAF continue to provide technical assistance, consultation via phone and VCON to local implementation teams throughout the state. We've also developed 14 new recovery homes for families who are struggling with addiction and are entering new recovery since the beginning of this initiative. And as Bob mentioned, about 670 child welfare parents have been referred using the new referral process from CAF to addiction treatment, and roughly 360 parents are enrolled in treatment right now. And just some of the interesting demographics, we wanted to see what was the primary drug of choice for these families, and the number one drug of choice is methamphetamine with 38%. 27% report marijuana as their primary drug, and then 26% report alcohol, and then the rest are other miscellaneous drugs of choice. And the average age of a child welfare parent is 30 years old. And just to illustrate how this initiative is working to heal and rebuild one Oregon family, and I'll call him Ted. Ted is a single dad living in a recovery house with his son. Ted had experienced periods of sobriety in his life, but as with other chronic conditions, he relapsed, and his serious addiction to alcohol required him to enter a detox program for withdrawal. His son was placed in foster care. Ted didn't have health insurance or a stable living environment when he was assessed as eligible for ITRS services. Within 1 week, Ted was enrolled in outpatient treatment following detox. He moved into a stable, drug-free recovery home, and he was matched with a recovery mentor during treatment, which helped him and continues to help him successfully navigate recovery and parenting responsibilities. And now Ted's son is living with him in the recovery home. And with that, I want to thank you again for the opportunity to be here and speak about this very important. It's actually one of the most fun initiatives that I've had the opportunity to work on since I've been with the Parker for 12 years, and exciting. I want to really thank you for having us here, and now I'm going to stop and turn. turn it over to Beth Kaczynski, who represents our treatment provider system and how this initiative is being played out locally.
Always. It's G-L-I, S as in Sam, C as in cat, Z as in zebra, I-N, S as in Sam, K-I. So I am Beth Kleshensky. I am the Director of Addiction Services at LifeWorks Northwest. LifeWorks Northwest is a fairly large community mental health provider that serves clients in Multnomah, Washington, and Clatsop counties. And I have been asked to talk here today about our experiences in implementing ITRS services within Multnomah County. LifeWorks Northwest has been a partner, along with several other agencies, the child welfare system and the juvenile court system, in a project called FIT, which has recently been renamed to FIT for Recovery. FIT was developed, I think, about 8 years ago in response to the Adoption and Safe Families Act, in an attempt to reduce wait times for families to enter treatment. Nationwide, the average wait time for a child welfare-involved family to enter treatment is upwards of 200 days. The FIT program wanted to reduce that, and they developed a collaboration. And it's been highly successful. FIT is a great program, works very well. However, it had limited resources. It had no additional actual treatment funding and was reliant on county slots to provide actual treatment services, but provided some additional adjunctive supports for families. ITRS was able to remedy that difficulty for the Fit for Recovery program. At this point in Multnomah County, we are able to offer Fit for Recovery services to any child welfare referred parent who is struggling with substance abuse issues. This is impressive, every single one. Along with the treatment services, we are, I believe, truly able to offer the recovery-oriented system of care that Karen talked about. We are able to offer parent training, mentors, case management services to ensure that the collaboration between child welfare, the juvenile court, and treatment services is strong, continuous, with ongoing communication, regular contact, physical presence in each other's rooms. I think that's a very important component of successful services. John Pearson, who was not able to be here today, wanted me to specifically speak about an element that perhaps other counties haven't been able to implement with their ITRS funding, which is a component of transitional housing. So in Multnomah County, they used a portion of this funding that was specified to support intensive outpatient services and purchased transitional housing services for clients who are engaged in those services. This solves a huge barrier that our clients have long struggled with, which is that they may be able to attend treatment, they may even have insurance to attend treatment, but if they can't afford housing, if they can't locate a safe, stable, and secure place to live with their children, perhaps they can't be reunited with their children, perhaps they cannot successfully into recovery at all. This has been a huge aspect of the success for the Fit for Recovery program in Multnomah County, something that I know that we're quite proud of, and something that I know John Pearson wanted me to specifically address with you. I also have a client story that I wanted to share. I wanted to talk specifically about this client, although she actually has the Oregon Health Plan, and so is not specifically eligible or doesn't specifically need the intensive outpatient component of the ITRS funding. She did, however, access the housing portion of this funding. So while we have many, many clients who have fortunately been able to access the intensive outpatient services because of this funding, she was not one of them. But this client, who I will call Heather, actually entered the Fit for Recovery Services program through residential treatment when she had her sixth child. Her previous five children had been removed from her care. So this was a last effort, and frankly, she may not have had that last effort.
but she was enrolled in residential treatment, spent a good portion of time there, entered our services at LifeWorks Northwest after she completed residential treatment for the outpatient step-down portion of care. She needed housing. I have the sense that she had not had housing and parents of her children independently at all. So this was an incredible step for her. She had, as I've written in my summary, multiple deficits. She had been prenatally exposed to alcohol, adopted herself because of a difficult childhood situation, had then been homeless and abused with her parents, was then living on the street as an adolescent, and continued on a pretty negative course. She successfully completed the residential treatment, but continued to respond to interactions with others with either physical or verbal aggression. That's something that she had learned. Successful treatment for her was a process of truly surrounding her with this recovery-oriented system of care. She had a case manager who went to her home and helped her with parenting and budget and household organization. She had a parent mentor. She had a housing case manager. She, of course, had her children and families case manager. She had a mental health therapist. She had an addictions therapist. She had a psychiatrist. And she recently completed treatment successfully. She's been clean and sober for over 2 years. She's living independently, and she just started job training. I think that this was universally nominated as by my treatment team as a classic example of what this ITRS funding, either all or in part, can do for families in Multnomah County. And I'd like to thank you for making that possible for us, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you about it today. Again, my name is Beth Wilkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for I hope you'll call me Faith because I'd like to call you back. Could you just give us a little more background? I'm interested in LifeWorks Northwest. You don't have to spend a lot of time. I'd just like to know more about the organization and its partnership.
LifeWorks Northwest, as I said, is a community mental health agency. We've been in business, I think, since 1971. Started as a child guidance clinic in Washington County. We've expanded quite a bit, particularly recently, and now have 630 employees and serve about 15,000 clients a year. One of the things I think that makes us unique is that we have, because we serve clients in three different counties, Multnomah County is, of course, a very urban setting. Washington County is much more of a suburban setting. We also provide services in Clatsop County, which is, of course, a rural setting. We implement ITRS services in all three counties as well, and implementing that initiative has been quite different in three counties, with three vastly different levels of funding, three vastly different existing sets of supports, etc.
Nonprofit, commercial, board. Funding.
We are a private nonprofit run by a board of directors.
And Madam Chair, I have one more question. Just a quick question, Karen, I don't want you to think I wasn't listening because I was, but I was. I just wondered if you could, it's nice to be here, but could you give me a reference, or just like some more data on the relationship between our two? That off the counter and his meth lab going to the other guys. Quite interesting. You recognize this, but I'd like to know where you get that or how we get it to the meth lab.
Sure.
If you could send that to
the meth
lab, that would be great.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Jessica Powell. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is a little bit generic in hopes that you'll bring back some additional information. Probably to Bob and to Karen. Bob and I were both in attendance at the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Programs recently and listened to a presentation from providers that what I took away from it was still some strain between the service providers providing addiction treatment and those providing mental health. And we talked about from the department end, we talked about addictions and mental health, and we talked about all these wraparound services, and I think we tend to just sort of then lump that together and kind of assume that all is coordinated, but from the provider perspective, I was hearing continued concern with co-occurring disorders and the difficulties of the funding flows going to one or the other. I heard some conversation today about the people being in addictions treatment and mental health treatment. And I think there's a real goal out there to bring those further together and to recognize that treatments aren't separate and distinct. But I'd like to hear more later from the department about how we're kind of looking at that and seeing if we can improve that continuing challenge for the service providers.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, thank you for raising the question. Gary Smith, another Governor's Council member, is raising some very interesting questions, I know, on the email world, and I'm going to be responding to that so that the entire council can get at least a perspective from my worldview. If I could just say, my simple mantra is this, and funding sources don't necessarily follow this, but I think we need to keep addictions issues and treatment services separate where they need to be separate, mental health treatment services separate where they need to be separate, and we need to integrate them where they need to be together. And I would argue that most of the clients in mental health and a fair number in addictions do have both sets of problems. And so what we really need to do, I think, is ground ourselves in what the needs of real people are and then make our systems and eventually our funding sources fit that.
I appreciate the department's efforts. And I felt it's sort of my obligation to carry back to this group some concerns that were raised with the Governor's Commission and Council. And hope that we kind of keep an eye on how the state manages to help our service providers develop or deliver services. Thank you, Rick.
Question. On the statistic about the average age of parents, that average age of 30, is that within the ICRS services or is that child welfare wide?
Representative Gelser. I believe that statistic came from CAF and it's child welfare wide.
I'm really surprised because I think often when we look at risk factors for child abuse and neglect, we talk about young parents having challenges. So that age of 30 really sticks out to me as something I wouldn't expect.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, we will send a confirming email to make sure the context is correct for that data point.
And then one other question was back for Beth. For Heather, how is her child?
I believe he's doing very well. He's with her. He's quite small yet, just two, so not in school, but has had a lot of support, as has his mom.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your report. It's a huge investment, as you've noted, and I think I'd like to thank Aaron, because in your position as Governor's Office advocate, this additional resource is really critical, so thank you. So when we come back to the budget cycle next year, I'm hoping we're going to see different numbers. You know, we all have seen the number of families in equity child welfare, the number of having access to them, and I've seen that percentage change. To that end, I have some question about your trajectory, and I know rollout takes time, and I know this is, you know, you're trying to do some very specific things, but to make sure I'm reading this right, so you have allocated enough through intensive outpatient to serve approximately 2,600 parents statewide, I assume by the end of the biennium. That 650 parents or thereabouts referred, a little more than half are getting into treatment. Are we going to hit that number? Are we going to see, you know, more or less full take-up by the end of the biennium? And is that a possibility? And I'm just curious where the drop-off happens between referrals to enrollment and what's going on there.
Chair Tomei and Representative Kotek, one of the challenges internally is the data systems. The CAF data system is a real-time data system, so the 600-plus people that have been referred, we can actually look at that today and determine exactly how many people have been referred. where our data system, which is called the Client Process Monitoring System, is not a real-time system. And so we have about 3 to 6 month lag time for that data. So I could look at that data today and know 3 months ago how many people had been enrolled in treatment, but not know what happened for the past 90 days. But we are working to look at this data on a very regular basis so that we can have accurate numbers. That's one issue. If each provider also had to get a unique provider number for this specific initiative, because we wanted to be able to track it separately from anything else that they were doing in their business. And that took the provider some time. So they are still going back and enrolling some of the clients who they had been serving even previous to contracts coming out, because we were able to retroactively allocate the funds since it was a financial assistance agreement with each county. So there's some cleanup in the data that needs to happen. There's also the possibility that we need to, that's why we're doing these visits, so that we can increase the number of referrals and people coming into these services. We also need to drill down another level. If people locally are thinking, well, we don't have enough referrals for people who've actually lost custody of their parents, of their children, rather, we need to drill down to another level of parents who have custody but might have an addiction issue and need treatment or need the type of services that we're funding here.
I would hope you would look into that, because, of course, we would like to present.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I think you're raising a good question. I think one thing that we could offer is an action plan with timelines that show how we expect to get to those numbers by the end of the biennium, because I think it's critical that we demonstrate that if we hope to come back and talk about this some more. So I'm committing to doing that.
Thank you. And just one of the things I also had a question about was the ineligibility of parents who are on OSP. I think I understand why that is, but could you get back to the committee of how many parents are we talking about? And, if they're able to get part, for example, some of the supported services, but not everything. I just don't have a sense of how many parents we're talking about. Though in need, though we want to keep them with their kids, they're not getting into this program. So. Thank you.
One last question.
All right. Thank you very much.
Hear from Erin Kelly Steele again and Nikki Lynn, and Director of the Oregon Commission on
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, again, in the interest of time, as Nikki makes her way here, Erin Kelly Steele, Interim Director of the Children, Adults, and Families Division. I'm actually going to start my portion of this discussion today and put on the hat I wore just 2 short months ago as the Governor's Human Services Policy Advisor, just to provide a little bit of context around the early childhood efforts in Oregon that have taken place thus far. Lyndon Johnson once said, "The task is great, the work is hard, often frustrating, and success is not a matter of days or months, but of years, and sometimes it may even be decades." And I like to use that quote when I talk about early childhood for 2 reasons. One, I think it illustrates the challenge that we are facing as a state to really meet the needs of our youngest citizens. And also, I think that it is illustrative of the time by which we will be able to see some of the results of the investments that we're making today. But what we do know for sure is that those investments do produce results, and the return on the investment in our youngest kids is one of the highest that we can make with our public dollars. In Oregon, I think one of the things that all of us have articulated as our vision for children is that every child would be healthy, safe, and thriving in a nurturing family and caring community. And it was that vision that drove the governor when proposing his budget in 2007, and I believe also drove you all as legislators in enacting and approving a budget that really did set Oregon apart nationally in terms of the level of investment we made in young children. As a result
of that investment, more Oregon children now get the mental health treatment they need. More young Oregon children can now benefit from pre-kindergarten and Head Start programs. More Oregon families are now eligible for monthly child care subsidy payments. More Oregon parents struggling to keep custody of their kids, as you just heard, now have access to substance abuse treatment. And more Oregon families giving birth to their first child now have access to parent education and support services. So, again, congratulations to the 2007 legislature, which all of you were a part, for those investments which are really having an impact on our youngest kids. I wanted also then just to as a segue to what Mickey will present at this higher level, let you know kind of back to where we've been today, focused on some of our child welfare specific information as it relates to young children. In 2007, there were 10,716 victims of child abuse and neglect. Nearly 50% of them were under the age of six. There were 12 child fatalities that were related to familial child abuse and neglect, and 10 of the victims, 10 of 12, were under the age of six. There were 15,060 children in 2007 who spent at least one day in foster care. 40% of those children were under the age of six. And for me, what those statistics really underscore is this bigger picture conversation that we are having in the state around how to prevent child abuse and neglect, keep children safe at home, but also meet children's needs early and often. And also then some information that I'd be happy to present, time permitting, about some of the efforts we're taking in child welfare specifically to better meet the needs of young kids and their parents. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Mickey.
Thank you, Erin. Thank you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mickey Lansing. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. I'm going to go back in history because Erin's quote that she began with speaks to what I'm going to say. In 1988, our then governor, toured every county in the state, and he asked them four questions. Tell me what you're doing on behalf of kids that you are really proud of. Tell me what your hopes and dreams for your kids and your families are. Tell me what isn't working. And fourth, tell me what the state can do for you in community that is going to help support kids and their families. Every county in August of 1988 came to the Capitol, room 50 downstairs, and presented a plan. And those plans included priorities for what they believed the state could do for them. Within the top three priorities of every single one, all 36 plans, was early childhood development and the need for parenting. Let's fast forward to 2001. House Bill 3659 passed, which required that the Oregon Department of Education, the Department of Human Services, the Employment Department, because that's where all the child care dollars are, and the Oregon Commission on Children and Families gather together and lead a joint effort and develop policies and procedures as it relates to an early childhood system. And what is our vision in Oregon for that system and our kids and families? Well, we all know that in 2001 we began that very, very difficult process of five sessions between 01 and 03 of budget reductions, and then had our sixth special session during the 03 session, which in effect challenged the capacity of our four agencies to really do what we needed to do as we started on this journey. It is now 2008. We are 20 years from what community said to the governor in 1988. That's two decades, speaking to what Erin had to say. We knew that in 2007 the governor was supportive and you were supportive of providing resources for prevention. With that, we had an opportunity from the National Governors Association to do an early childhood summit, a governor's early childhood summit. So our agencies got together, and we enlisted the help of three primary private sector organizations. And this is very important.
and that's the Children's Institute in Portland, Northwest Early Childhood Institute, and the Oregon Community Foundation, and started to look at how can we put this summit together, how can this be a public-private partnership, and what can Oregon now do in not only creating the vision, but really develop strategies to implement what it is we want to have happen. So in March of this year, we had over 300 people attend the summit. It was packed. We almost had to turn people away. It was made up of legislators, of public policy people, mayors, boards of county commissioners, pediatricians, internists, all positions from all different specialty areas, national early childhood advocacy groups, National Governors Association, researchers, people from higher ed, practitioners, parents who every day work with these particular issues. Early intervention, businesses, foundations, corporations. These were our most knowledgeable and influential people who wanted to take a look at what is it that we in Oregon can do. As a result of that, you have and were given a summary and also this little piece called Early Childhood Matters.
Where
I delivered that to Rick last week, your office. Copies for all of you.
We'll get copies of them.
Okay, they're in your office.
Some problems.
Our office, yeah, box up on the
room. They're somewhere in the box.
Madam Chair, I just suggest that we push up some order.
Well, what this actually outlines is there's really three areas that we are looking at and developing strategies for. That's family supports, health, that includes behavioral health, physical health, oral health, and early learning. And those three areas are outlined in this piece along with the strategies that communities are going to take on. A handbook of all the strategies and then tools for how communities can move forward is being developed at this very moment and should be ready by the end of this month and will be sent out to communities. Almost every county has what we call an early childhood team that is looking locally at what it is they're going to do. And we at the state level, along with our private partners, are developing the supports that hopefully can be helpful in them moving forward. Integral to all of this work that we are doing is people agree that we need to build on the success of what we already have. We don't need to create something new. What we know is that we have things already in place that need to be built upon. There is a common will to truly develop this, not only comprehensive vision, but the comprehensive system of supports that kids and their families need, and they need it prenatally, up to the age of beginning school. And it's not only about children being ready for school. It's about schools being ready for children. And I'm not going to go into it, but the whole educational piece is so very important as it relates to the supports necessary for kids and their families. We believe that Oregon's early childhood system is poised. We have the way. We believe we have the will. We have gotten resources from you, and we are moving forward. But we are also, the success of what we do has so much to do with our private partners, and they have been absolutely integral and invaluable in moving this agenda forward. I also just want to take the opportunity to thank Erin, because her leadership in the governor's office truly has helped us get this off the ground. But we are very, very hopeful. And when you look at child safety and the kinds of things that we do have in place in Oregon, the kind of data that we now have, and people starting to connect all of our systems together and the impact that can make, we're really trying to start to align resources and get private resources to help us do what we already know needs to be done. Questions.
Chair Tomei, if I may just for one more moment, and if you would indulge me on just one, a couple other pieces of information I wanted to make sure that you have from us in child welfare and in CAF more broadly. I think one of the challenges around this issue in particular is to focus the effort on the needs of the child and the family, not on the way that our agencies are organized or the way that our programs are currently delivered. This is a similar challenge facing us in meeting kids' behavioral health needs, frankly. It's a challenge that it's just a shift in paradigm in terms of how we talk about these things. But, of course, the tools that we have at our disposal to implement strategies are driven by the way that our agencies are organized and the way that our programs are currently delivered. And what I wanted to do was just get a little bit more specific for you with respect to CAF about some of the different programs that we currently administer that support this broader effort to better meet young kids' needs. And when you look at the framework document, what you'll see is that there are three policy focus areas, and they were defined by the policy and by the policy, not by an agency or program intentionally. One of them is health, social, emotional development, and mental health. The second is safety, family support, and parent education. And the third is early care and education. And within the Children, Adults, and Families Division, we actually have programs that support each of those policy areas for young children and their families. We haven't spent much time today talking about our self-sufficiency programs in the Children, Adults, and Families Division, but I would be remiss if I did not tell you that those programs play an incredibly critical role for all parents and children, but also in particular for parents of younger children, as an early intervention and support network for them. To highlight some data that is an update to you, I think you all got an update on our temporary assistance for needy family programs redesign implementation effort. One of the programs that was grown as a result of the investment in that redesign in 2007 is called Family Supports and Connections. It is an early intervention program, and it targets families who particularly are at risk of ultimately losing custody of their children to the child welfare system. In 2007, the agency supported with the legislature an estimate. We thought we would be referred about 500 families to that program on a quarterly basis. To date in 2008, our referrals to that program are around 900, not 500. But again, this is a program in particular that is an early intervention prevention focus on family stability, increasing parental protective capacity, and decreasing risk factors that lead to child abuse and neglect. This is a program that relates directly to our ability to reduce the number of child abuse and neglect victims that happened at the child abuse neglect victims here in Oregon.
Who makes the referrals? The caseworkers?
Yes, when a family comes in the door. I'm sorry? Chair to make, Representative Kotick. Yes, there are two ways that referrals can occur. One is when a family comes through the door, the caseworker evaluates their circumstances and can say this family may be eligible and should be considered for this particular program area. And individuals who may know about the program can also self-refer, as well as community partners who may know about the program and may say to us in our self-sufficiency program, please consider this family. There are a myriad of other programs within self-sufficiency that include things like parenting classes and other early intervention services. We also have another large program in self-sufficiency called employment-related daycare. That's a program through which we subsidize childcare for working families. And many of the children that are served in that program happen to be young children. And the efforts that we make through the investments in that program to train and improve the quality of the childcare that is delivered to those families directly impacts the early care and education for young kids. We also, as you know, have formerly what has been called the food stamp program and the new name, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, that we administer in the Children, Adults, and Families Division. There are over 470,000 Oregonians today who use those nutrition benefits. Most of those individuals are children. And the impact that nutrition has on the health of our young children, I think this committee understands very well, so I won't spend much time on it. Within child welfare, specifically, I mentioned some data earlier about the number of children who are in foster care being about 40% that are young kids. This doesn't mean that the kids that are over the age of 6 aren't a focus for us. I just am highlighting that data point to suggest to you all that as we look at the services that we deliver to families, both the services we provide to families in their homes when they are trying to retain custody at the outset of their children. In these cases, there has been a founded abuse and neglect determination, but the courts and child welfare are recommending the child stay home. We provide family-based support services for those families in all 36 counties, and that can include things like family therapy-based services, parent training, intensive home-based services, and other services designed to really keep the family intact. Those same services are offered when a family who has to a family and child, when the child has had to go into foster care and the child returns home, and we want to be able to safely keep that child in their home. And again, it's another opportunity for the child welfare system to have a positive impact on a child, a young child, and their parents. So I know that that's a quick, very quick overview of just some of the program areas in child welfare, in the Children, Adults, and Families Division that impact this issue of early childhood. There are a host of others across other divisions in DHS and other agencies across the state. But again, the driver here is less on the way the program is organized and more about what are the outcomes that we really want to see for children and their families.
The first one is, when you talked about the early childhood birth to six and then our early childhood programs, are there any challenges that come with programs that are primarily designed to serve young children that are birth to 3 years old when we look at those statistics of children who are victims of abuse and neglect being from birth to six? How are we targeting services to those 4 to 6 year olds?
Representative Gelser, I will speak at a higher level, and then I have a resource in the audience that I would like to ask to come forward. Jan, are you here? Thank you. I think it is this issue around infant toddler 0 to 3 versus children 4 to 6 is a challenge for the entire continuum of early childhood service delivery, and I think what we're recognizing are a couple of things. The needs of infants and toddlers and the needs that parents have at that age level are higher. I can speak to that myself. I have a 7-month-old and a 3-year-old, and so the needs are different and they look different for those young children and their families. And it should, because those needs are different, that needs to drive the way that we talk about how we provide child care subsidies to those families, the way that we provide parenting supports to those families, the way we intervene earlier with those families. Specifically within child welfare, though, I would ask Jan to come forward and tell you a little bit about what we do today and what we're trying to do going into the future that may address this particular issue.
Chair Toomey and Representative Gelser, just while Jan's coming up here, address the issue of 0 to 3 or prenatal 0 to 3, because we do have a couple of programs, Healthy Start, Babies First, Cocoon, and Relief Nurseries that specifically work with the prenatal to 3 population. But of course, we have funding restraints. Healthy Start was always meant to do prenatal to 5 years of age, but because of funding, they really do it only to 3 years of age, and same with Relief Nurseries.
Chair Tomei and Vice Chair Gelser, if I understand your question, it was about...
Please identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm Jan Slick. I'm the Family-Based Services Program Manager at Child Welfare. Are there more challenges in serving the 4 to 6 year old children's mental health needs? Was that the question?
No, that's not the question at all. Thanks for the opportunity to clarify. I think my concern, and this came up, I had the opportunity to serve on the child safety group that Dr. Goldberg put together. And we talked a little bit about how do you reduce the incidence of abuse and neglect for children. And we spent a lot of time talking about, you know, beefing up our investment in primary prevention and programs like Healthy Start. But my concern was, what about those kids that are 4 to 6? And so even though we have the data that shows young children, birth to 6, are half of those that are victims, half of them are over 6. And even within that half, a good portion of those are aged 4 to 6. So if you're a kid and you're at risk and you're 4.5 or 5 years old, Healthy Start isn't going to help you. What are we doing for that population of kids, and do we need to look at the way that we're structuring early childhood? If we have early childhood statistics that go from 0 to 6,
but our early childhood programs are prenatal to 3. How is it that we get at that group of kids that are 4 to 6 to keep them safe?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilstrap, thank you for the clarification. One of the largest programs that we have that I believe addresses that issue is Head Start. Within Head Start, there is one of the advantages and one of the reasons Oregon's Head Start program has received the accolades that it has is that we have a very comprehensive set of family supports that are offered to families that are eligible for our Head Start program. And I believe that one of the ways that we intervene early and best with those 4 to 6-year-olds and their families and begin to address issues like addiction or like mental health or the domestic violence issues, which are some of our primary drivers with respect to abuse and neglect, are through those family support advocates that operate through our Head Start program. Now, it is very true, obviously, that not every child is eligible in Oregon for Head Start, but there was a significant expansion this last session in, to grow the program to serve a larger percentage of children who are currently eligible. But I think you make a very good point on a different level, which is we really need to, now that we have more macro data, one of our challenges always as we try to make database decisions is to dive deeper and begin to cut the data different ways and identify really, okay, for those kids that are 4 to 6, what are the factors that are driving for those kids and parents their entry into care or the abuse issue. One of the defaults I would go back to was the discussion we went to earlier around addiction issues. We know that those issues are the most prevalent among kids that are being abused. And so I think also another prevention program that's now implemented and that we need to expand on is the effort we're making around those addiction treatment services we spoke about earlier. But I don't know if Jan or Mickey maybe want to also add to that.
Yes, that's my
follow-up. I think part of that, Darren and I have had this discussion at length. We had this discussion in the Child Safety Work Group. We had a really hard time in that group trying to figure out how to wrap our arms around those kids who may not be eligible for Healthy Start. They may not be eligible for Head Start. But these are kids who have referrals to the Department of Human Services for allegations of abuse, and those allegations aren't founded. But we know those kids are at a really high risk for further abuse or neglect. We just weren't able to found that. And if you go back and you look through the data and you look at some of the high-profile cases of child abuse, child fatalities that we've seen in the state of Oregon, that's that group of kids. So I continue to be very concerned about how, in a time of limited resources, we target that group of kids that we know is at the very highest set of risks because they've already come to our attention, even though they might not hit those other risk factors. And I'm particularly concerned about that as we move after our revenue forecast last week, where we look at being, I think it was $500 million below essential budget level. I think part of providing great services to kids is looking at what do we have that's working really, really well, and is it better to shift resources into that or to grow everything a little bit. And I think on that, and this is just information I would be interested in learning more about. We had some discussion in that child safety work group about the difference between Healthy Start and the nurse home visiting program, what the outcomes are, what the verified outside data is from outside resources, not just necessarily from within the agencies that are administering the program. And I think moving into the next session, it would be very helpful to see some of that external data. What are the outcomes? How are we measuring success? And where do we best invest our dollars to protect our kids and make sure that they aren't becoming victims of abuse and neglect, not just those 4 to 3, but also those 4 to 6 and those 7, 8, and 9-year-olds that are at risk too.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, I think those are excellent questions, and of course we have been struggling with some of those issues because we helped staff that particular committee. But I think one of the things that is on the horizon that you'll be pleased about is that the commission system, the Department of Human Services, is entering into an agreement with Casey Family Programs, a foundation out of Seattle that deals specifically with these kinds of issues. And they are going to be giving us some additional help around what other states are doing in order to, number one, keep kids safe in their own homes, even before they, this is not just kids who have come to the attention of the child welfare system in that they are on the caseload, but where there has been an unfounded case of abuse, what is it that we need to do, what community resources are available for those particular families. And that's just one of the issues. We're going to be looking at the issue of disproportionality in terms of children and youth of color in our child welfare system, as well as juvenile justice and some other things. But we're going to get some additional help, and that's going to be very helpful based upon our revenue picture. And I will tell you that Healthy Starts data and the results for the population they serve is the same as Nurse Family Partnership in terms of the actual outcomes and results at this point in time in the state of Oregon.
Erin, do you want to present the results? And Mickey, when will we hear the results of the Casey Foundation?
Certainly, that actually was a point I thought I might make. We would offer, acknowledging that in the fall, everyone's committee schedules are beginning to get more more busy, although it's hard to imagine one that's more busy than today. But one of the offers I think that we could make is to come back and do a full report on that agreement, as well as a series of other initiatives within the Child Welfare Division in partnership also with the Addictions and Mental Health Division, the Commission on Children and Families, et cetera, because we have set some goals for ourselves around safely reducing the number of children in foster care. And obviously one of our challenges is to begin to address that issue even with limited resources. But as Nikki said, we have some additional technical support as well as some financial support coming our way, and we have a series of strategies that we are implementing, and we would be happy to come back and do a report to the committee on that.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, Erin Kelly Steele, and we are here to talk, give you a very brief update on our efforts around the Child Welfare Staffing Study, as well as some of our efforts to improve our internal processes through the what is known within the Department of Human Services as the Transformation Initiative. I just thought I could provide a very brief bit of context, and then I'm going to turn it over to Jim, who's really our expert in this. But in 2003, the legislature directed the Department of Human Services, particularly within the Children, Adults, and Families Division, to take a look at moving from a caseload to a workload staffing model. Part of this was an acknowledgement that as time has gone by, the challenges and the requirements for each of the program areas that are administered in the Children, Adults, and Families Division, and I will speak specifically about us today, have grown, and we needed to think about how maybe to assess differently the need for a workforce to meet those challenges. One of the things that I think is often forgotten when folks think about the Department of Human Services and about Children, Adults, and Families Division particularly, as a department-wide, within DHS, about 80% of the resource is actually goes out into communities and is delivered by community partners and is not a direct service that the Department of Human Services actually administers. CAF is really the exception to that. We have a workforce of approximately 4,500 people, and we deliver direct services in the areas of vocational rehabilitation, self-sufficiency, as well as child welfare. And so we are different in many respects, and we have a different role that we play statewide in communities because of the way that we're organized. There were three CAF-related studies looking at the issue of workload, in other words, how the work is done versus the quantity of cases that one might carry. The first was with food stamps and Medicaid in 2005. The second looked at the temporary assistance for needy family programs as well as vocational rehabilitation in 2007, and the last was just completed this year in 2008, looking at child welfare. And I thought, just to highlight for an example, and Jim will get into this in more detail later, but in looking at the translation between where we are today, which is we've been receiving an allocation of staff based on a caseload model, and where we would need to be if that allocation was based on a workload model. In child welfare, McKinsey estimated that we are operating at between a 24 to 37% deficit in terms of our staffing. And what I want to underscore just by making this point is that this isn't just about getting more staff or more bureaucracy for DHS. This really has to do with our ability within the Children, Adults, and Families Division to deliver the quality of work that our citizens expect of us and that you all should expect of us. And what these studies looked at are, what does it take to actually meet our federal standards? What does it take to comply with current state law and policies? And how can we avoid excess costs attributable to overtime that often must accumulate because we are understaffed? So again, this is not about quality for us. This is really about quality. And with that, I want to turn it over to Jim to give you a more detailed overview.
Thank you. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Jim Neely, Deputy Assistant Director for CAF Field Operations. And I'll just add in a few things to what Aaron has talked about. One of the most important things about the workload studies that have been done for us is it has not only given us a point-in-time picture of what our workload needs are, but each of them has also added a methodology so that we can update those studies on our own over time, which is really the most critical portion of that whole process. Because as Aaron mentioned, the business changes on a daily or weekly basis. So looking at either a caseload or a workload standard that's several years old is really not very informative. So we have two distinct steps that we're looking at in implementing the workload model. Step one really is starting now, sharing information about the differences between what the workload model shows for staffing needs and what the older caseload model showed. And I'll give you a little demonstration of that in a moment. In the financial update report that we will be presenting to the emergency board in September, really for the first time, we'll be showing both models in terms of what the workload need is. Now, we won't be asking for additional staff at this September update, but we will be using the new model, which really for everybody I think gives a much better picture of what the workload needs really are. So step two, then, will be to work with you in the legislature to figure out how to begin bridging that gap. And as Aaron mentioned, just on the child welfare side, the 24 to 37% gap, if we took the upper range of that and said there's a 37% gap between our current staffing resource and what we actually needed, that would be about 600 case managers for child welfare. Now, I'm not sure what we do with 600 case managers at this point. Just the hiring and training of that many staff, not to mention where we would put them, would be a very difficult process. So the intersection of the workload studies and the transformation is critical here, because what we're doing starting, that we've already started, really is to look at how can we reduce the need for staff by simplifying and streamlining our processes. So that really is the other critical component of this. And it's also the other reason that on a routine basis we'll be updating the workload model as we change our procedures to streamline them, and thus in almost all cases require fewer staff. We'll be able to reassess what the current workload is and give you folks a better idea of what that workload need is compared to the resource that we have on hand. As I mentioned, we've already started the look at streamlining our processes through the transformation work that McKinsey and Company has done with us, instituting what's known as a lean methodology, and looking at rapid process improvements for a number of processes that we have. And in the handout,
If you go back to the attachments, does the gap between the current gap between capacity, supply, and workload really shows what? And this is an excerpt from the Child Welfare Staffing Study. Shows what McKinsey and Company look at our staffing did in terms of basically determining our current capacity, looking at the work that we'd like to be able to do now, the work that we should be doing now and can't. That's another 17% to 23% above our current capacity. Looking at additional 2008 policy requirements, raising service quality, relieving supervisors of casework duties, and reducing caseworker overtime. That adds up to the 124 to 137% of current capacity there. So as we are able to reduce the current work or anywhere along this continuum, that will also reduce the need for staff, and those two processes go hand in hand. The page that shows prioritization of initiatives for child welfare, it's got a little grid on it. This is an example of some of the things that in working with McKinsey and Company, we have identified as areas in which we can streamline our processes and have some savings in terms of actual workload need. And these individual operational initiatives, starting with 01, decreased time spent by caseworkers on clerical tasks by increasing utilization and efficiency of clerical and support staff. That'll be one of the first things, in fact, that we're already working on, looking at what support staff can do that caseworkers are currently doing. Of course, that also means we have to take a look at support staff functions and minimize what they're doing now or streamline their operation to give them more capacity as well. And they're then charted on this grid that show how much of an impact we estimate they would have on workload, and this is a relative estimate, and then how achievable that is, how difficult is it versus how much we're likely to get out of it. And as you can see, initiative one is very high in terms of its impact, so we're going to be spending a fair amount of time in that process. The next chart that shows proposed CAF branch RPI implementation and the RPI, again, rapid process improvement events. This is how we started. In fact, we have done round one currently on the self-sufficiency side and already done a child welfare rapid process improvement event on the adoptions process and looking at reducing the central office time that adoptions process takes. And so what we're doing is we are clustering large, medium, and small branches in these process improvement events. One, we've just spent 3 weeks in the Albany branch, including Albany, Springfield branch, and Medford and Grants Pass branches in that process to look at primarily on the food stamp application side, what can we do to streamline that process, making it both better for clients and more timely. The goal that was set by the folks that are doing this, and these are line staff, support staff, caseworkers, and supervisors that do these events. Their goal was to take from 7 to 10 days for regular intake appointments and expedited appointments as well for people that need very quick service, and reduce that from down to 3 days for regular appointments and same-day service for expedited service. And they believe in going through the process that they have actually achieved that. So the next step then will be to replicate that in the next group of branches, make sure that they're getting to the same conclusion, which the lean process would lead them to, iron out any differences between those processes and then implement those statewide so we get these improvements across the board. the other very important piece of this is that it will help ensure consistency across all of our branch offices. We have about 100 branch offices out there, and consistency is a very important issue for us, so that people get the same service and the same outcomes in branch A as they do in branch B or C. And that's currently not as consistent as we'd like it. And then finally, the very last page just shows a point-in-time analysis. If we, in looking at the child welfare position comparison, 24% to 37% capacity difference, if we set the bar at the midpoint there at about a 30% difference, this is a comparison of various positions in child welfare in terms of what the currently authorized positions are, positions earned through the old caseload model, positions earned through the workload model, and the difference to where we are now. So for caseworkers, currently have 1,197 positions. The caseload model would be 1,495. The workload model shows 1,670. And so for about a 472 position difference. Now, this difference will decrease as we continue on with the rapid process improvements and streamline the work that they're able to do. Now, exactly how much we'll get out of that is to be determined.
Representative Tomei, if I may, just in closing, I think one of the reasons we are really appreciative of the opportunity to present this to you all as a policy body, and not just be having this conversation with the Budget Committee because they actually appropriate our staff, is that you all are making policy decisions that impact those programs and then, of course, get passed along to the budget discussion. And I think for us, we believe that it's very important for you to also understand our ability as it relates to our capacity to carry out the policy direction that you all give to us and to our program areas. I think Jim mentioned that there are two ways that we are proposing to close the gap that we want to continue discussion with you on. One are the operational improvements that Jim alluded to, and these are critical for us. They go beyond the focus is to improve our ability to serve our clients and reduce waste, and that is something that we are incredibly committed to, that Dr. Goldberg is committed to as an agency-wide effort, and CAF is really leading the way on this because of how critical it is as for us as direct service providers to take this challenge on and to meet it. The second issue is to have the conversation about additional staffing resources that may be required as we move through the discussion. That's a budget issue, but what impacts our ability to close the gap also are two other things. One are policy changes, some of which don't come from you, some of which come from our federal partners as well. And the other is our caseload. And I think it's, in the interest of just making sure people are aware in these challenging economic times, as it becomes more challenging for you and for us to meet the capacity issues we face with staffing, the pressures on our staff are growing. Within our mandated TANF caseload, just as one example, we are running at a 25% higher than budgeted caseload right now. Our food stamp caseload is up generally above the forecast to the tune of 8 or 9%. And so I think it's important to just draw the connection between the policy that you all make, the impact that the economy has on our ability to meet the need in the community, and then the budget resource that then ultimately meet our staffing need. And all of this is interrelated. So we very much appreciate the chance to give you what I know was a very high-level overview of these efforts, and we'd be happy to provide additional information as you would like it.
Thank you. I have my first question here. So on the page, we're talking about what you can do about the work. So the gap between 24% and 37%. So adding 35% to 53% more FTE. I'm just wondering how you got that figure when it sounds like the gap might be as much as 37%.
Chair Tomei, the issue with the FTE percentage being different than the workload gap is that for every additional percent of workload, it takes 1.4 FTE to fill that workload based on available time for individual staff, discounting sick time, vacation, mandatory administrative work, etc.
Any further questions? Representative Cote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks again for having this presentation. This is, I think, a critical one, especially as we move into the next session, if we're going to. We're asking the department to do a lot, and I think this, the whole initiative, the workload focus is really important. I have two questions. The first is on, this is the first time I've seen the scatter chart on the prioritization of initiatives in child welfare and self-sufficiency. Very helpful. Two questions, I guess, on that. One is, how did you come up with the prioritization? What's the input process from stakeholders? And on the one on self-sufficiency, I'm particularly interested in seeing us move up on the chart, this number 7 around simplifying TANF case management processes, because I am very concerned that we've asked the department to do some very major shift change on TANF redesign, and I'm worried about caseload, workload. That one seems to have a high impact and high achievability. So, again, how did you come up with the prioritization of general bumps to the
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, the prioritization here, well, first let me say that I think there was a fair amount of vetting with the Family Services Review Commission, for instance, in terms of what the McKinsey folks were working with us to find here and what some of the highest priority issues are. On the one hand, while I think they've gotten a fair amount of vetting, I think it would be a mistake to think of them as linear in progression because, for instance, particularly with TANF case management as an example, we're already doing some things in that regard, for instance, to simplify attendance reporting and have some computer system changes already in the works that likely within the next 2 months will be pushed out there. So while we have I would say a tentative prioritization here, I think as we go along and work on particular RPIs, these will naturally change, and we are interested in input from really any quarter in terms of what folks think are some of the most important things for us to do. But it's not necessarily a one-at-a-time approach that we're taking here.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, if I could add two things. One is that for us, stakeholder involvement, not just in feedback around what happens and when, is critical, but also in the RPI processes themselves. And we have invited external partners to be at each of those tables. It's a 4-day commitment, but those individuals that have participated with us thus far in the last 5 weeks of implementation have given incredibly positive feedback around their ability to understand better some of our challenges, but also there's been positive feedback from our staff about the ability of those individuals to help inform and improve the work that comes out of the RPI, the rapid process improvement efforts. I think the only other point I would make is that one of the work product efforts currently underway is to develop a more detailed schedule around how these things will roll out and which in particular of the initiatives will be rolling out in which community and when. It's been an incredible undertaking for us because we do have 100 branch offices. We have many, many people we need to touch with this, and we need to do it thoughtfully so that this isn't something that just happens at a central office level or even in an individual branch and then does not actually also then resonate and penetrate across the state. And so we're in the process of working on how to do that, and we would be happy to provide you with that update once we get that particular piece of information together.
So in another revealing chart is the position comparison. It's nice to see those numbers. Did McKinsey or will McKinsey be giving you a prioritization of the staff classes for highest impact? For example, given everything they've learned and what you're trying to do, it makes more sense to have more support staff, for example. And as we know, maybe not less expensive FTEs than buying a full caseworker. Are they going to give you that before they depart? I know that their contract is coming to a close very quickly. That will determine what kind of FTE you are probably able to allocate.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek. Actually, McKinsey did the child welfare staffing study under an earlier contract, and they are finished with that. But what they've done with that is they look primarily at the frontline caseworker and social services assistant workload there. So I think we'll be doing a couple of different things. We'll also be looking at extending that to a supervisory ratio and other support staff issues, probably as a next round in terms of what we'll look at. But probably more importantly, that mix will probably change substantially as we go through these RPIs and determine how much work support staff can do that caseworkers are now doing, which may dramatically decrease the need for a large number of case managers and may increase the need more for office specialists, as an example. So I believe that mix will change, but the other piece that we really have to do as kind of our next round of staffing study is get the rest of the child welfare grouping in there so we can see how those pieces interplay.
So would you anticipate having essentially maybe an end of biennium reshoot before we make the final budget decisions in May of next year? Because when we allocate for the next biennium with the effects of RPI and all the other improvements, we want to make the best purchase possible with being in the next biennium. So is that your anticipation to have some of those new numbers, maybe a reshoot of the... I see that's not. I know it's hard because you're going to be asked to do, you know, a proposal now and then a proposal again. This is kind of a developing process when we get to the budget.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, the simple answer, I believe, is yes. We will update the information so that everyone is using the most current status, if you will, of all of these efforts upon which to make a budget decision.
Thank you. I know that would be a lot of
questions. Any further questions? Thank you so much,
Representative. Oh, I'm sorry.
Just real quick, you mentioned raising service quality. What do you measure and how do you measure service quality?
Chair Tomei, Mr. Bacobian, I think that's a really good question. We have a couple of different specific efforts that I can point to that I believe are part of the answer, although I think there's a larger one. We've also been working with the Family Services Review Commission on a client survey because we can, one of the ways that I think we would measure quality and that we do measure quality today is looking at what we call our dashboard information. These are outcome performance measures that we use to evaluate our program area and how we're doing. For example, one that has gotten a lot of attention recently is our efforts to improve our face-to-face contact with clients by caseworkers, and we're currently very close to meeting the original goal set by Dr. Goldberg of 80% within a 30-day period of families having a face-to-face contact with a child. Some of the way that I think we will evaluate our impact is our ability to move those dashboard measures, but a second way is also more directly something we've been hearing from our advocate partners about with respect to the need to really survey clients and evaluate, are we doing better from their perspective in terms of the way we deliver service and how they receive it. And so we're working on developing a survey so that we can have both a baseline as an evaluation tool for further survey opportunity of clients. And then there are some very simple metrics. Each one of these initiatives is required to have what they call a metric, in other words, a measurement of progress toward a particular goal. And perhaps as a segue to the conversation that we're about to have on adoption, another RPI event that just occurred in the central office was focused on our adoption process and the time it takes for us in central office to process the information that is provided to us by local caseworkers and then effectively free a child for adoption. Right now, currently, it takes us approximately 200 to 400 days to get through that process. The goal that we are setting for ourselves through this rapid process improvement and the process we've identified that should get us to the goal is 45 days in terms of a cycle time for that paperwork internally within the agency. The quality that we should hopefully be able to see ultimately is that when we begin to report back to you on adoptions information and the time it takes for us to find an adoptive placement for a child, that that time will be reduced because that child has permanency more quickly as a result of the effort. So there are several ways that I think quality will be evaluated in terms of an impact.
Any further questions? Thank you so much. Erin, we're going to give you a break. We're going to come back at 20 minutes after 11. And colleagues, I'm hoping that we can be through by 12:30. We may not make that. That's what I'm aiming for. So I know, Erin, we've kept you here for a long time without a break. So we're going to take a quick break. And then we'll start with a smile. And I hope there's more than one. Okay. We're going to hear from Erin again, of course, and now Nancy Keeling about the adoption process. Colleagues, I know that Representative Gelter and I were on the committee that looked at the adoption process after there was some problems on the coast from adoption gone wry. And so we've been meeting Nancy and Erin and some other folks. Represented a couple of other representatives. So this is one of the issues that I think that our committee should be looking at both now and in the 09 session. So.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. Erin Kelly Steele, I think this is the last you have to hear from me today. As Chair Tomei mentioned, we're here just to provide you an update on some efforts that we are making to improve and strengthen, really, our adoption selection process. This is an area that often gets a lot of attention, and there is good reason for that, but it's sometimes, again, I think important to look at just this within the bigger picture of the work that we do in child welfare. One of the overall goals that we have that I alluded to earlier is that we would very much like to be able to safely reduce the number of children who are in our foster care system, which means that we are doing a better job keeping them at home with their families when they can be there safely. It means that we're doing a better job moving them through and out of foster care in a more timely way. And also, sometimes when they cannot return home in that circumstance, it means moving them into a different kind of permanent relationship with a parent or guardian. And adoption is a huge part of that for us. We have several strategies that we're working on to try and help us achieve the goal of safely reducing the number of kids in our foster care system. And I think it's interesting to look in 2007 at where children who were leaving foster care went. The majority of those children were reunified with their families, 64% of those children, and you have a data sheet from us that just gives you an outline of this information. With respect to adoption, I think I should also say that 18% of those of children who were exiting foster care were adopted. And we on average, each year have finalized about 1,000 adoptions. So when you look at of those finalized adoptions, about 37.5% were actually with a relative, and those children were adopted by a relative. About 38% were adopted by a non-relative foster parent, so someone with whom they had a relationship already in foster care, and then the remaining 25% were adopted by a non-related non-foster parent. So in short, about 75% of the children in Oregon who were adopted in 2007 at least were adopted either by a foster parent or by a relative. And I think that that dynamic, that data actually sets up some of the dynamic that that has gone into the bigger policy questions that arise with respect to how we choose families. And the only other thing I would add as an overview is to remember that for child welfare, we are in the business of serving the child. Our job and our primary goal and objective is to meet that child's needs and to find the family that can best meet the needs of the child. There are other organizations that do yeoman's work for families who are looking to adopt children and come at this work from a very different perspective, which is more the perspective of from a family who is seeking to adopt a child. But for us in child welfare, as we serve children who are in foster care, who cannot go home to their parents, and who still are deserving of a permanent placement and a permanent home, our job is to find the family that best meets their needs. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Nancy Keeling.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Nancy Keeling, and I'm the administrator of the Office of Safety and Permanency for Children at Children, Adults, and Families. And that office has the administrative responsibility for policy and practice development of all six of the primary child welfare programs, and adoptions is one of those programs. It's my pleasure today to share with you the department's vision and progress in addressing the adoption selection process. And as I listened to Chair Tomei's opening comments, I realized that not all of you have been involved in this process with us. So I'm going to just take a couple of minutes to talk about the piece of the adoption process we're talking about today is the adoption committee process. And the part that has become controversial or has gotten a lot of attention is really around the issue of children who have been in a foster care placement for a certain length of time with folks who have then become attached or bonded to them and want to adopt them, and at the same time a relative resource has been identified for that child. And so it becomes that dilemma around a child's right to grow up in their family of origin and the attachment and bonding issues for children and how that fits on a case-by-case basis and a child-by-child basis. So that's kind of the background of what brought us to looking at the adoption process. As a bit of history, in March of 2007, the department requested the National Resource Center on Adoptions to come to Oregon and conduct a review of the adoption selection process and make recommendations for the improvements that they thought would be helpful to us. We made that request based on the number of times we were beginning to see cases come into central office with a lot of controversy around that very issue of current caretakers or foster parents and relatives both wanting to adopt the same child and being at conflict about that. The request was prompted by those kinds of cases, and about the same time this happened, we received a report and became very involved in a very high-profile case, and that was the case that Chair Tomei was referencing. The case caught a lot of media attention, and it also caught a lot of public attention. And so a legislative sensitive review committee was convened. One of the things that you'll find in your handouts, and I'm just going to refer you to that for later, is a matrix. And what this matrix is the compilation of the work that we've done in response to the recommendations that came from the National Resource Center and from the sensitive review committee. And so it talks, the matrix talks about what the issue or the recommendation was, who it came from, and what the plan from the department is to try to address those concerns. When we began to get recommendations and started to look at those, the first thing, of course, we did was formed a work group that would have a lot of stakeholders and community partners involved. The central office staff, as well as field staff who had expertise in permanency and adoptions, were participated. CASAs participated in that, Juvenile Rights Project, Citizen Review Board, and many other stakeholders and adoptive parents who were known to the agency came together and really looked at the recommendations that had come from both the National Resource Center and the Sensitive Review Committee and began to pile through those and see how they thought we could best address those concerns. So what I wanted to talk a little bit about today was sort of the overall vision that came from that process. It really centers on making a fair, open, and transparent process that focuses on finding the very best family for the child. And as Erin was saying earlier, the task before the Department of Human Services is to find a family for a child, not to find a child for a family. And so that becomes part of the struggle sometimes. I wanted to highlight for you today just a few of the priorities that this committee has offered to the department and some of the progress that we've made on those things. So the first thing we did was we really shifted in the adoption committee process the information that the committee considers and how it's documented. both the Sensitive Review Committee and the National Resource Center recommended that we focus on the child's needs and not so much on the families that were being presented. And it's very important to look at the families and their home studies and read about them. But what we really need to do is look at, here's a child who needs a permanent family. These are the child's needs. And how can each of these families meet those needs? And who has the best skills? Skill set or the best relationship in order to do that. And so that was a little bit of a shift just in the way that the committee considers information. Another document that we have provided for you is a draft of the new format for looking at the adoption selection process. The legislators who participated in the Sensitive Review Committee on the high-profile case gave us some very strong feedback that those in the department could look at one of these and have a pretty good sense of what happened in a committee, but when other folks looked at it, there wasn't enough information, it wasn't organized very thoughtfully, and it was difficult for people to see how the committee considered information and then came to the conclusion that they came to as far as a recommendation. And so this is the draft report that they've put together that hopefully will address that concern. The second thing that I wanted to talk a little bit about is both of the groups who gave us recommendations suggested that how we share information was very important. And in regard to parties such as CASAs and child's attorneys receiving information and then how they were able to present their thoughts about the child that they've been involved with in relation to the information they've read. So currently, CASAs and attorneys for children do receive the home studies of all the people who are being considered as a potential permanent resource for the child. Those home studies are redacted so that third-party information or confidential medical or alcohol and drug information may be redacted. But other than that, the basic information in the home study is given to them, and they're able to read that ahead of time. What we've changed in the process now is as they come in and provide information that they know about the child and share information, we've also invited them to make a recommendation from their perspective and their involvement with the child, which family they believe would best meet the child's needs. So that's something a little bit different than's happened in the past. And then the third thing that I wanted to talk about was just the feedback process, how information gets shared with families who have been considered. Previously, adoption workers who had presented the family to the committee would call the family afterwards and just talk with them about the committee process and let them know whether they had or had not been selected as the resource for the child. What we've done with that is really we're actually drafting a procedure and rule that will have the worker have a face-to-face contact with the family if it's possible or if the family's requesting. If the family's in Virginia, we're not going to put them on a plane and fly them out for a face-to-face contact. But for the most part, workers would have the ability to sit down with the family. They'll have the information that's from the new report, and we'll be able to actually go through and specifically talk with them without breaking the confidentiality of the other families considered, talk with them about the child's needs and how the child's needs can best be met by the family that was selected. Our goal in doing that is to be more open and transparent to all families who've come forward and offered themselves as a resource for Oregon's children, but also to hopefully help minimize the conflicts that we're hearing. If people know more specifically how decisions are being made, we're hoping that that will be helpful to them in being able to figure out how they will be in the child's life in a different way if they're not the adopted resource that's been selected. So that's the other thing. And then finally, there remains a policy issue that I've spoken with both groups about and with the Sensitive Review Committee group about. And that issue really surrounds the inherent conflict that we have both in administrative rule and in statute between these current caretakers or foster parents and relatives. Currently, the conflict has been a primary driver in the controversy, and currently the way the statute in our rule reads is that if you're a foster parent and you've had a child in your home for a consistent 6 months, then you can achieve what is called current caretaker status. What that does is puts those folks at equal standing with a relative at 6 months. The reason it's become such a conflict is, rightfully so, our task is to provide, our number one permanency goal is reunification with parents. And so the agency works very diligently to reunify children with their parents. And a part of that is the child and the parent being able to continue to have a lot of contact during the first part of the case. We are looking for relatives very early on. You folks, your committee and other legislators did a very nice job last session, and I thank you of assisting us in prioritizing relatives for families and giving us some direction around how to give preference to relatives, and we're looking at, or we are doing that. In doing that, though, if you've identified a relative very early on in a case who says, yep, I want to be the resource, you go through the interstate compact, you get a home study done, you're beyond 6 months by then. And so you have a relative who's viable, who has a relationship, who knows the child, or who wants to be a part of the child's life, who has a positive home study, and would be likely to be someone we could say, this will be the resource if the child doesn't return to home. At the same time, we have a foster parent who is falling in love and bonding with the child and who now has equal standing with that family member. And so it's a policy question I think we need to grapple with, and that together we need to really think about how we might make that less controversial. The real answer is to do the work up front, to not get to the point where we get to committees at 18 months and a child is 18 months bonded with a foster family and a relative lives far away and has only been able to see the child twice. I mean, the real trick is to figure out how to work on the front end of the case as we do those things. So I wanted to just raise that question or that policy issue for you to be thinking about. But to give you just a little bit of context as I close, I wanted to share with you the other data information that we provided. It's on the backside, I think, of the information Aaron was sharing with you. And this data really covers a time period of about 36 months when we began to really keep the data on committees themselves. We have about 1,000 adoptions a year, and during this 36-month time frame, 66 cases that came before the Sensitive Review Committee did have a request for a review. 23 of those cases we did not grant a review, and the review is an administrative review. It comes in, and you know the things that we're looking at administratively was, did the committee get all the information that was available to them? Did they consider it thoughtfully? You know, were they provided with adequate information about the child's needs? All of those kinds of things are what you look at. If all those things are in place and the committee made a thoughtful decision that is within policy, then no review is granted. 44 cases we did grant reviews. 26 of those cases were relatives and non-relative current caretakers. It was foster parents and relatives. And in 16 of those situations, we did grant reviews and did do reviews. The outcomes of the relatives versus the current caretaker cases that were reviewed were 11 of them were upheld. 3 were upheld with a selection of a relative, 1 changed from a relative to a current caretaker, and 1 changed from a current caretaker to a relative. The other process that people have, if there is a request for review and denied, then they have certainly the legal right to ask for a judicial review. And in 6 circumstances, families did seek legal representation and did get the opportunity to have judicial reviews of the adoption committee decision. And in those situations, 4 of the 6 cases were upheld. 1 was upheld and then not upheld and then later overturned at the Court of Appeals. So that became 5 of the 6 cases were actually upheld eventually. And 1 was referred back to the agency for reconsideration. So it sort of gives you a perspective of, and I know, I think each and every one of you has at some point had a contact from a family who's been in this dilemma. I think I've heard from most of you from one time or another. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about some of the things we're doing to address some of the concerns.
Nancy, we don't have that form in front of us, do we? I have it at home, but I didn't.
This one?
I think it's really important to point out that only 1 was overturned by the court out of 1,000 cases. So we hear about the ones where there are problems, people have questions, but only 1 was overturned. I think that's really important. And in the Sensitive Review Committee, colleagues, there was a Supreme Court justice plus at least 2 other judges, right, who helped us look at this and what kind of information they wanted to help them learn enough about adoption cases so that they can make good decisions if they come before the court. So I think the process is wonderful. And I did want to say, I thought that we had a concurrence in this group that we would change the legislation so that foster families would not have, what was the phrase, in standing until 12 months. So I assume that's what it would take to change that. It wouldn't just be administrative rules.
Exactly, yes.
The other suggestions could be changed administratively, but this had to be changed through legislation, correct?
Kirsten told me that's correct.
And so this is one of the committee bills that I'm hoping that our committee will... Oh, I'm getting a good look.
Oh, it's not a very look. I don't think we had unanimous concurrence.
You weren't there. You weren't there. It's unanimous for all the people
not
who were there.
Not to tip my opinion.
I'm sorry. I did not mean to imply that. But actually, this is the last meeting. We weren't able to attend when there was concurrence. So, anyway, this will be one of the committee bills. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This was a long process. There were hundreds and hundreds of dollars put into it, and I think it was just a very fruitful process. And I think the committee did good work in serving staff. So
thank you.
Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just really had a couple of comments and a quick question for Aaron. Thank you very much. You know, back when we were talking about psychotropic medicines, I was remembering how tough your job is, and that was about 3 hours ago. So thank you very much for being here and for your service in this area. One quick housekeeping. Before you leave, during the break, I was talking to Ruth McKeown, who's back here, and she's going to be talking to some other issues. But we were talking about this whole issue of growing population. Grandparents and great grandparents. And I just hope you two make the connection for you. I just want to mention that to you. The chair will not be surprised that my questions are a little out of order, so I can make a couple of quick comments about previous issues.
Yes, sir.
You gave us a great macro, as you mentioned, of a number of really important issues. I want to ask you a quick micro issue that you can defer for later. But first, you told us not to call them food stamps. I mean, you broke your own rule. Our nutritional supplemental program, is that probably called?
SNAP.
I'm just interested in SNAP from this standpoint. Are those big honking frappuccinos that we now can get instantaneously in the grocery store eligible under SNAP? And the reason I say that is I just recently saw this week article. I enjoy those meals. And it's the worst nutrition according to this article. And I'm just wondering if that's eligible.
I will have to confirm that my answer is correct, but my answer is no, because the general rule with respect to food stamps is that food that is prepared in some way, something that is hot, like a hot dog or a hamburger, you cannot use supplemental nutrition. I think we're still actually referring to the actual benefit as a food stamp benefit, but to the program as SNAP. But someone will correct me, I'm sure, about that. But in any event, the answer, to my knowledge, is no. If I'm wrong, I will correct myself.
That's helpful. One follow-up, if I may, Madam Chair. I just wanted to commend you and then ask you a question about partnerships. You know, I meant it when I said this is a daunting task. I mean, you're a huge. I think you have a lot of intelligent and supportive members of this committee that can help you and me, too. But you can't do it alone. And so when I see LifeWorks, that's why I asked the question to LifeWorks and not heard of them. And then when I see, we can go back to Mickey's testimony, and you get Mickey's gift as well. I see all these partnerships. I just want to encourage that. I have one question about it, but I want to encourage that because I believe that there are just so many resources nationally, but in our state, that can help you. And if you're reaching out and looking for them, I mean, it has to be appropriate, it has to be within the bounds of the law, but we're going to need a lot of heavy lifting from a lot of partners. administrators to make again at any of these things that we have. So I want to always encourage reaching out to the private, nonprofit, the commercial, wherever we find things that work for people with their kids. I did want to ask on that one, and again, this may not be in your area, but in the back of this booklet, it lists the partnerships. And of course, we don't want just people willy-nilly to call and say, hey, put me on the list. But how do you get on the list? And, you know, there's family and advocacy partners. There's one here. I remember the first time I heard of this group, I thought it was Stanford Children. It's Stanford Children. How did they get on the list, and what do they do in partnership with you?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, it's a good question. In putting that document together, one of our challenges was that there are partners that are not on the list, and it was not intended to be a list that was exclusive. In fact, one of the things that the private sector, and in particular some of our community foundation partners, have an interest in doing is creating an early childhood website for Oregon that they would sponsor and create, and that would be more comprehensive than that very small summary document that you have in front of you. That list was compiled based on partners that have engaged in the early childhood discussion very directly, very consistently with the state for quite some time. However, we got lots of calls and responses when we hosted the summit from individuals who would like to be added to the list. And so I believe the next step is to continue working with the private sector to develop the website that will include a much more comprehensive list of folks, and I think it's one of those situations where we would say, y'all come. Anyone who would like to be a supporter and a partner with us in the effort is welcome.
That's all. Thank you.
Good questions, Representative. Any further questions? All right. Thank you so much, Nancy. Aaron, you are doing just a fantastic job. We are so lucky to have you in this agency. Thank you so much for all the work you do and for the energy and the ability that you bring to this position.
Thank you for having us today.
Okay, now we're going to go for general assistance for people applying for Social Security benefits. Kathy Cooper, John Mullen, and Brenda Jones.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Cooper. I'm the Deputy Assistant Director for Seniors and People with Disabilities within the Department of Human Services. And I'm really excited today to be here to talk to you about a program that the state had to eliminate several years ago during our budget cuts in 2003-05. And we, as a department, are proposing through a policy option package to restore and to restructure what used to be known as the General Assistance Program. I've done a very simple summary of the policy option package for you today, and then have included in your packet the full policy option package. Again, what we hope to do is restore the General Assistance Program back to its prior program, really focusing on people who are individuals that will meet the Social Security disability criteria but have not yet gone through the Social Security process for getting the Social Security income or Social Security disability. We hope that the General Assistance Program in the future would be both providing a small cash grant to individuals, as well as the very important part, which is the medical coverage under the Oregon Health Plan Plus program. And we see that having both of those components and our ability to case manage these individuals as they go through the application process for Social Security, as well as any appeals they might have, will really benefit them in achieving the goal of really getting the Social Security disability payments that they need to really survive. So who would be the people we see being served? We look back over the history of general assistance, and we felt the group that we could target that we believe was a viable group would be individuals that both have physical and a mental illness that is at a severity that would meet the Social Security criteria. And we believe that that would be the best way, because then as they go through the process of application for Social Security income, we would be able to do some recoveries of those benefits. We looked at what we would be able to do in terms of a grant. $314 was the amount we arrived at. Again, I think we could go anywhere looking at inflation and other costs today and ask really how much $314 will buy. But at least it gives people cash in their pocket to really achieve just the very basic minimal requirements of shelter and food. We also hope that they will, and we will help them with their OHP plus benefits, and the medical benefits is a really key important piece for these individuals. We would require individuals that sign up for the general assistance program to apply for Social Security income benefits and to sign an interim agreement of assistance as a condition of their eligibility. And the reason for that is if they apply for Social Security income benefits, then the state is able to recover the portion that we pay out, which is the cash benefit, which is the $314 a month when they actually receive their award. We tried to go back in our history and tried to determine how many people were on the general assistance program before it was closed down, and then looked at our current numbers of people that are coming in right now under what we call our presumptive Medicaid disability program. We felt in the next biennium we could serve about 1,500 people in the first biennium, 09-11, and then in 11-13 serve up to about 2,700 individuals in Oregon. We really believe that having the general assistance program fills one of those safety net gaps that continues to raise its head in communities throughout the state of Oregon. It really is focused on individual Oregonians that don't have children, that have not yet been able to get Social Security benefits, and really don't get any other cash assistance from any of the other programs that we run in the department. And it's a group of people that many times when you talk to your law enforcement, you talk to your mental health communities, providers, you talk to other providers in your community, they're the people that fall through this sort of the safety net of our society. And since our program has closed, we see reoccurring issues of people that just cannot get services. So this really fills a gap. So the department went through the process of looking how to do this. And as I said, we thought the best way to do it was to align the GEA program with the Social Security requirements, because we will be able to do the recoveries of those cash payments. At this point, we looked at the assumptions and what we thought the program would cost if we restored the program, and it's approximately $35 million to start the general assistance program again. We see that about $5 million of that would be a general fund cost for the actual cash payments. We receive about 70% recovery of those payments when the person actually gets their Social Security benefit award. It usually takes us, though, about a year and a half to 2 years to see that recovery. And we're even actually today still recovering from the old GA program as people finally get through the Social Security process and get that award. We also see about $3 million in the cost for our staff and the program analysts for our Social Security disability staff that would help individuals and case manage them through the eligibility and the hearings process.
And then the largest ticket item, again, always is the cost of the Oregon Health Plan Plus, which is about $27 million. We assumed when we did these numbers that at least a third of these people have presented themselves to the department already. They have gone through what we call a presumptive Medicaid disability determination. And so we've already factored that into our numbers when we looked at the cost of the health plan. And we also thought the implementation would be $314 a month was the assumption we used, and that we would help the person through their determination and any follow-up they would need to make sure they get their benefit. So the department right now has submitted this as a policy option package to the Department of Administrative Services for the governor's consideration in his recommended budget. We again know that the department, the governor, and the legislature is going to be faced with a number of priorities and having to make some very, very tough decisions as we go into this next budget cycle. But we did want to let you know we have submitted it on to the Department of Administrative Services at this time.
Thank you. So the $27 million in medical costs, that would not be recovered by the federal government.
Madam Chair, that is absolutely correct.
So what we could hope to gain would be 70% of the $5 million.
That is absolutely correct. Yes, Ms.
Kathy, I guess I missed it, but why was this program removed?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, the department was faced with major budget cuts in 2003-2005, and the legislature chose to remove this program because it was primarily funded with a general fund dollar.
And my other question is, what is the response time from application to receive assistance?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, when a person applies for the general assistance program, it usually takes us about 90 days to be able to get them eligible to get their health plan card and their general assistance cash payment to them. When they apply for Social Security benefits, it takes us anywhere from 18 months to 2 years to get them fully eligible.
Colleagues, a lot of this came to our attention. I bet we got calls from constituents, as did I, after the stories came out in the Oregonian about how appalling the situation is. These people have nothing. These are the ones that really do fall between the cracks. We have no services available. And so these are the homeless people that are getting nothing from the state. And so I'm very This is a big price tag, though, however. As I recall, if we'd kept this going at the rate that we had it in 2001, then it was, if my memory, like $2 million a year. I mean, that is a lot different from $35 million.
Madam Chair, one of the considerations, and I should identify myself for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. One of the things that the legislature will need to weigh out is the whole issue of the cost of this program from a variety of perspectives. For example, just about everybody that would be eligible for general assistance is already eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, so it's not as though these are folks that will add additional cost per se because they are already eligible. In addition, if the Oregon Health Fund Board recommendations are realized and OHP becomes just one program, not plus and standard, and it's opened up to everybody, these folks will be automatically eligible by virtue of their income. So the cost factors, which is why I've always encouraged SPD, seniors and people with disabilities, to single out the cash assistance, staffing cost, and the medical cost, because the medical cost is actually quite a complex discussion, because when the legislature decides who shall be covered by the Oregon Health Plan in the next session, these are folks that would rise to the top and be covered in any case, where the general assistance is reestablished or not.
But only a small proportion of them are on the Oregon Health Plan now. Is that correct?
That's correct. There are people, as Kathy Cooper mentioned, that are presumptively eligible for Medicaid, but there are people that have not applied that would also
right.
be presumptively eligible for Medicaid.
So that's part of this whole process, right, is identifying these people, giving them enough money so they can stay in one place, whether it's a room in a hotel, some place where they can be reached and they can finish the process of applying for SSI, correct?
Exactly.
And also applying for Medicaid.
Madam Chair, Representative had a question on this. Good point, but I wanted to follow up. You had mentioned about the cost. When we did cut the program, it wasn't as much as this, which is in the beginning of the coverage. So, just the restart of
right.
Representative Olson was asking what the difference between MLB and one office and the panel. And the only difference being that we now have an SSI, SSDI track for family and kids. These are everyone who don't have.
But you're right. We're trying to create success. Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back. I just want to be on record to say that I prefer when Representative Kotek asks Representative Olson's questions. But just want to understand the quote loss, because I see the advantage. But I was a little confused. Eventually, dealing with beds, we get 70% back. So there's a 30% loss in the program that we can charge, mostly to administrative, which is understandable, I suppose. But is there another? You mentioned a couple other factors. Is that part of the 30% that we have to beat to make this work?
Madam Chair, Representative Gillum, I think I'm tracking your question, and that is that of the $35 million, we're able to recover it's 70% of the $5 million, which is the cash benefit. When the individual is eligible for the Oregon Health Plan Plus program, then we're able to get 60% recovery or match with the funds from the federal government for Medicaid. So it's there are several steps to figuring out the dollar amount.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the POP, thank you for bringing this. On item number 5, where it talks about needing to change an existing statute or require a new statute, you say no. Is there an advantage of putting in the statute? I mean, I think one of the reasons this program was targeted is because it's not anywhere in the statute. I'm questioning whether there is a discussion whether we should have some kind of legislative concept to establish a program in the statute to some degree.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I believe we have a very broad statute that describes general assistance in a very common term that allowed us to operate this program in the past and would allow us to continue to operate this program. It's also the statute that allows us to do the TANF general assistance and other parts of the programs we operate. So our response to the question was, did we need statutory authority? We believe we already have it.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, again for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and I'm very pleased to be here to talk about general assistance. I know that members of the committee are all already aware of the Oregon Law Center and what it is that we do, but I just wanted to underscore the whole issue that for us, this is one of our highest student services priorities, because these are folks that have been talked about as the poorest of the poor, and this is an important part of our mission. I also want to acknowledge Stephanie Thomas-Sweet, who is doing the convening work for our GA working group from the Oregon Food Bank. We have an impressive list of organizations that you will see in her testimony that are concerned about general assistance because it is cross-cutting across so many different programs in so many different communities in the state. But I also want to start out by thanking you for the 2007 session, House Bill 3139, that this committee heard and discussed at some length, and in addition, took the extra step to send a letter to Ways and Means saying this is something that really ought to be funded. Very grateful for that, because we really felt that this committee really understood and was really very concerned about the program. In addition, I also want to acknowledge your work, and particularly Representative Cowan's work, on Senate Bill 1061 in the 2008 session, which in essence did a number of things. I refer to it as the omnibus bill for seniors and people with disabilities. But in Section 2, it talks about directing the department to restore the general assistance program. I did in my testimony, by the way, I provided the statute for you, the general assistance statute, because as you will see as you look at it, it is very, very general indeed. And in fact, general assistance in the history piece that I did that is also connected to my testimony gives a little bit of background about where general assistance came from and the changes it's been through during the years. But basically, I'm not going to go over very much of the programmatic issues, because I know you're well-versed in this, and also Kathy Cooper did a good job in outlining this. But I do want to thank and acknowledge the department for bringing forth this policy option package. In my testimony, though, you will see that I did have some initial concern, and I did talk with Kathy about this, that I don't think that the POP policy option package reads very clearly. But basically, we wanted to make sure that the program did indeed cover people who would have SSI, Supplemental Security Income, and Social Security Disability Income, that they would have those folks that had that eligibility be able to apply. We did have, as one last gasp of the general assistance program, a program that was limited to people that could only qualify for SSI. So when you think about it, what that really means is that it really excluded people that had any work history. And it was a very cumbersome and clumsy program to administer, and we had only a shadow of the caseload we once had under general assistance. And also in reference to Representative Kotek's point about the work that you all did on House Bill 2469, which was Representative Kotek's bill, but the committee worked very hard on all of that. The track that was developed for people who were eligible for SSI, SSDI was really a wonderful thing to see that implemented. And in my update, I also provide some information about how CAF is doing, Children, Adults, and Families is doing with that particular program, because there have been a number of people where a disability benefit track was the best option for them and for their family. And so one of the reasons why it's important, I believe, to have that same kind of consistency with what we did with CAF is another quick example that I would like to give. And that is somebody who I met recently, who I believe is the first person to move off of the TANF SSI-SSDI program to absolutely nothing as far as cash assistance. The reason that she moved off is that her child moved away to college. And this is a person who had a work history and has disabling conditions longer than your arm. I spent time talking with her about her conditions, and I don't understand all of the medical technology and terminology. But in any event, what we have in the absence of a general assistance program is not only the people out there that are eligible, but potentially the people that would fall out of the TANF SSI-SSDI program. So that's a concern I also wanted to draw your attention to. A third point that I want to raise, but I'll do this in passing, is the basis for, I think, having the discussion here today, as you pointed out, Madam Chair, about the articles that were in the Oregonian about the disability benefits and the backlog. I simply went ahead and took a look at some of the stories that were in the Oregonian, as well as some studies on the national level, and then some thought about a future discussion for this committee and perhaps for the legislature is to take a look at what we can do about disability determination, the role that the state plays. The articles, of course, were aimed at the backlog at the federal level, but there are issues that need to be addressed at the state level. The state does a very good job. It actually is a bit above the federal standards for my review of that, about people who initially apply for disability benefits. But as the department's engaging in all sorts of transformative kinds of ways of looking at work, this is something we may want to come back to at some point in time. So in conclusion, I just want to just mention a couple of things. The main one being that for me, as far as looking at issues for people with disabilities, the lack of a general assistance program is a really gaping hole there. We do a number of different things that were talked about in a very excellent op-ed by Representative Kotek about how we need to have a strong vocational rehabilitation system. The work that was done on 2469 in the 2007 session. But in fact, this program, the lack of a program on a community level is really very striking. And you'll hear from a minute from Brenda Durbin from Clackamas County about some of the things that she sees from a local perspective. So I would just, in answer to another question that came up, another conclusion that I would like to bring to your attention is that at least I believe that what I would like to see is a committee bill, if possible, that follows along the lines of House Bill 3139. Because as you take a look at the statute, the general assistance statute, you'll see it's very broad and it's not very specific. It's fine that it's there. And I'm happy that it's still in statute. But in fact, the legislature may very well want to legislate around this issue and say this is what we would like the program to look like. Other than that, the way the existing statute stands, it really gives the department a broad amount of discretion. And while I love working with my DHS counterparts, occasionally I think it does make sense to memorialize in statute what the intent of the legislature would be. So. Once again, just to conclude to say that I really thank you for the opportunity today to talk with you and addressing this issue as far as the poorest of the poor in Oregon is concerned will be a great benefit to all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative
Kostek, is this an issue that you would be willing to talk about? Yes, I'm sure. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brenda Durbin, and I'm the director of Clackamas County Social Services. I'm here representing O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disability. And I thank you for this opportunity to speak to the importance of restoring the general assistance program. Clackamas County Social Services ran the GA program from 1990 until its final closure in 2005. Over the course of those two closures, more than 200 of our clients lost services. The loss of the GA program was clearly devastating to our clients who had benefited from the services that they had received. In the words of one GA recipient, the monthly income from GA kept the wolves from the door, and once they lost that monthly income, for many, they lost even that door. Coinciding with the closure of the General Assistance Program, Clackamas County Social Services had an opportunity to apply for a grant from the Social Security Administration called HOPE, Homeless Outreach Project and Evaluation. And the goal of the HOPE project was to determine if providing homeless disabled individuals with trained case management assistance in applying for Social Security determinations would make a difference in the final outcome of their application. The population served by the HOPE project is actually a subset of that population that would be eligible for the GA program. They're disabled, and additionally, they're also homeless. We had several successes in the HOPE program, and because of the similarities, I think that the outcomes of the HOPE project can be used to illustrate the importance of bringing back the GA program. Perhaps most importantly, we did find out that providing a skilled case manager does indeed lead to speedier determinations at the Social Security level. The average time for determination for a HOPE project participant was only 67 days, and this compares to an average of 88 days for applicants who apply without any trained specialists. One of the things that we really focused on with HOPE was getting it right the first time. Very few people are approved that first time they apply. Most people have to go through a determination and hearing process. If you can do it right the first time, you're looking at maybe 67 days, maybe 90 days, compared to several years if you have to go through the hearing process. So we're really focused on getting it right the first time. And factors contributing to the success of this initial determination rate included developing really close working relationships with the staff at DDS, the Disability Determination Services. Our staff also learned how to properly present a case for consideration. It's a complex process, and if you know some of the ins and outs, you can get that application done effectively and efficiently. We also found that the development of that relationship between the case manager and the client was really important. These are folks with numerous disabilities, and in the case of the HOPE Project, they were also homeless. Most folks needed intensive assistance at every step of the way. So while I do appreciate the department's policy option package, they are recommending a regionalization of the SSA liaison process. And myself and other directors of local area agencies on aging and disability feel very strongly that the program is going to be more effective if that staff is located in our local office where we're already providing services to individuals who have disabilities. We know the local resources. We can hook them up to other opportunities to get them through. So I just make that one comment. There's clearly an economic impact to local communities of getting this determination done quickly and effectively. The monthly SSI benefit is $637 a month. That's federal money that comes into our local communities that would not be coming in without a successful application. There's also tremendous cost for uncompensated care for these individuals who have no medical care while they're waiting for their determination. We did an informal study of HOPE participants and found that the minimum cost per person for uncompensated care was over $12,000 a year. We assisted one local hospital to receive over $70,000 in uncompensated care for care that they had provided to HOPE participants. And that access to health care is so very important. It's crucial to individuals' physical and mental well-being, and it prevents costly emergency room visits, which increase everyone's health care costs. A significant number of individuals who need GEA are suffering from mental health conditions, which additionally impede their ability to successfully obtain these benefits. And without treatment and support to follow through with the application process, these individuals can languish on our streets, in our emergency rooms, and in our jails. In the HOPE Project, we found that 82% of our participants had a significant mental illness that contributed to their disability. We also found impacts on the criminal justice system. We had 20 HOPE participants who came to us directly from the criminal justice system. Most of these folks immediately exiting the jail into the HOPE Project. We only had a 10% recidivism rate for our clientele. That compares quite favorably to a national average of 67%. And when you look at the cost, I have a number here back in 2001, $36,000 a year to incarcerate an inmate. That compares quite favorably to providing them minimal cash assistance and the Oregon Health Plan benefits that can help them maintain their lives without resorting to criminal activity. So we have a number of models of success as we look at the exciting possibility of maybe bringing back GA. We've got our experience with HOPE. There's an existing project in Portland for Central City Concern called BEST that's doing very similar work and having even more success in getting that determination done quickly and efficiently. And in 2006, State Addiction and Mental Health Services received a grant assistance to do something called SOAR that trained a wide range of case managers in how to help their clients successfully apply for SSI and SSDI. So in closing, I'd just like to say that because of the hard work and dedication of the entire HOPE team, 72 formerly homeless individuals who experienced chronic disabling conditions now have a steady source of income. When the GEA program closed, we were serving nearly three times that many. The GEA program helps individuals avoid uncompensated health care costs, can possibly reduce costs to the criminal justice system, and contributes to more to our local economies. So I'm just left with the question, why would anyone bring back this program? And I thank you very much for your time. We'll welcome any questions that you have.
Thank you, Brenda. Any questions? Any of you here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask you, Brenda, thanks for being here. It's good to see you. Just say a little bit more about HOPE, because I'm interested in what my audience, if you said this, I apologize. Is it over?
Is it before over. It was a four-year demonstration project.
And that's it. And we were helping about a third of the folks that we previously helped.
Correct.
So when the federal government made this available, was it their intention
spur states on to programs like, in Oregon's case, reinstituting the general assistance program? Or was it, were they trying to make a point or do a study where they would have additional assistance? Is all hope lost with the federal government?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, I believe that the federal government has no intention of continuing on this program. It was a pilot project to see if providing that case management made a difference. It did make a difference. My understanding is that these were one-time funds, and we don't have any expectation of additional funding from the federal government for a similar program.
Madam Chair, if I might, just to add to that very quickly, and Representative Gilliam, one of the things that, though outside of the HOPE program discussion, that obviously the federal government is interested to see states do these kinds of programs because they provide a mechanism for reimbursement. So that's a compact that goes way back to the Depression era. So what was on Social Security's mind about doing projects like that is something I'm not entirely sure any of us know, but part of it had to do with looking at their disability determination process. I know that much. But in any event, it is an interesting thing to think about, that the federal government is interested to see states do these types of programs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to thank you for the presentation that you've given, and also thank you to the department for putting together the policy option package. One of the questions I had for the committee, Representative Kotek has agreed to work on a committee bill that might be a little bit more expansive, but would we as a committee like to follow up on what we had done last session in terms of sending a letter on to Ways and Means supporting the reinstitution of general assistance by sending a letter from our committee to the governor's office and DHS expressing our ongoing support for this and the wide support that the reinstitution of general assistance had during the 2007 session from the body general?
I think that's a terrific idea. Do you have some information here?
Yeah.
Terrific, great idea. So, Representative Delta, would you like to work with me and with Rick? Yeah, I'm closing for the last one. Great, thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
I'm sorry.
Well, no, this chair is so low. I'm down here.
I'd just like to get a little bit of clarification, if we could, in terms of the cost, because I think that the $38 million is sort of a daunting figure. And I don't think that reflects general fund cost versus federal funds, so that I believe the balance that I was seeing in some other documents was closer to an $18 million general fund impact. Could you help clarify that?
Madam Chair, Representative Cohen, I will go back and actually try to pull those numbers apart, because I think it depends upon when the person actually becomes eligible for the health plan and then how much we're able to match with the federal dollar. I mean, the largest piece of this cost is really the OHP plus portion. So I will try to go back and get you at closer numbers.
And I think perhaps it isn't terribly necessary immediately, but I raise it just as a thought process for the committee. As we move forward, we will see some reflections as we look at the fiscal impact in those recovery dollars, both the federal and of the Oregon Health Plan, and the federal dollars from approved SSI compensation. So the net is not a $35 million general fund yet.
Could it be closer to what do you think?
Some initial figures that I've seen in the course of other conversations was closer to 18, but I don't want to put any firm dollars on it. I'm not the fiscal guru, but I just think it would be important to keep in our minds that that's not the total general fund cost. Is that fair to say?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Helen, that is actually correct.
And if you could share that information with Rick, then we'll direct it. Thank you very much for your testimony. For reminding us about how wonderful this is. Representative
Gilliam, I think that's great. How does a letter like the description go?
Yes, I suggested that Representative Gelser meet with Representative Spock with me and Rick about
stopped asking such a letter, then we would pass it along to the rest of the committee, make sure everybody is in agreement with that. Is there a problem with that?
Madam Chair,
yes.
I do believe that I have stuck a signed statement somewhere that Representative Gillian said I can always speak for. I saw that. Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that we're on a timeline, and, but I did. We do have the testimony from the Oregon Food Bank's Coliseum. And if you haven't had a chance to glance at it on the second page, every year, or every 2 years, I believe, the Food Bank Network has a survey of the emergency food box recipients. And they haven't published their final report, but 21% of recipients eating food boxes every month have a disability that prevented them from working. So you get a sense of the impact in the nonprofit charitable world and not having some public program to help these folks.
That's a great point. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. Representative Cowan, you've been working really hard through this effort.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate a spot on the agenda because I think it is important to bring the full committee sort of up to speed on where we are. The subcommittee of this committee that's looking at issues for seniors and people with physical disabilities won't meet again until the middle of the month when we'll meet jointly with the Senate committee. But in the meantime, there's been a lot of work that's been done, and I'd like to keep folks kind of up to date. Every now and then when I start talking about this, I realize that I have to step back a little bit because I've kind of moved from all these reasons over here to solutions, and occasionally people say, what are you talking about? What system were you talking about? But so I think it is important to remember that Oregon's long-term care system for people, for seniors and people with physical disabilities, was conceived decades ago, and the system's pioneers recorded their vision in ORS 410. The system they envisioned served frail and vulnerable Oregonians in the least restrictive setting possible, taking into consideration the independence, choice, and dignity of each individual. And sometimes we lose that as we're looking at the big picture, and Oregon really is very different than a number of other states. Some of the demographics, though, that are familiar to this committee are really staggering in terms of the growth of the elderly population. The over 85 age group is the fastest growing percentage of our population right now. And some of these figures were shared with the Revenue Committee last week, which were just shocking to members of the Revenue Committee. And I found that interesting. Some of us have been so entrenched in it. It's like, you didn't know we were getting old? I knew I was getting old. But they really were very interested and have begun to talk about some potential revenue sources for supporting some of the work that we're trying to do. But as you will recall, in 2008, we kind of tried to focus legislative intent when we put together Senate Bill 1061. And that was two parts, directive to develop a comprehensive plan, asking the Department of Human Services to take a look at the long-term care system for seniors and people with physical disabilities. And then secondly, to report on cost projections for some of the key components that we had singled out. And I want to clarify something that I heard just a few minutes ago. Let's remember that the second session of Senate Bill 1061 asked for cost projections. It can't be considered a directive to reestablish any particular programs that were in that list. So in relationship to general assistance, it's certainly part of that conversation, but we're trying to look at costs, and it wasn't intended as a directive to do everything on that list. However, I very much appreciate the work that's been done around general assistance, and I've kind of left it out of a lot of what we're doing with the understanding that Representative Kotek and others were working on that. But what I'm really pleased to see is the excellent stakeholder participation that continues in this discussion. And I've kind of stepped back and let the stakeholder group do the work and take a look at initially the comprehensive plan that came out in its first draft from the department, and then some of the stakeholders supplied their input, and we're kind of moving through what the finalized plan will look like, but that is very much on target and will be available to us as a report for the 2009 session. And secondly, the group has really stayed together and begun to review the rest of those pieces of Section 2 of 1061. And we have sort of a big picture plan now, along with some cost projections initially, and that's why I think that, you know, some of these numbers will get sorted out. That's somewhere in the $135 to $140 million price tag if we do everything that we'd like to do initially. But I think that will come to us in various ways. I just would like to sort of detail what some of the things that we're looking at are and help you understand that the challenge to me right now is that some of these items will be addressed within the department's budget process, come through in policy option packages, and we're trying to kind of figure out what's likely to stay in that in a proposed departmental budget and get to the governor and come out in a governor's recommended budget, because that's one direction that we talk about some of the things that we need to do. And then secondly, which pieces of that need to come out in a separate piece of legislation that hopefully will have a revenue piece attached to it that we may need to do outside of the governor's recommended budget. So right now I'm going to lump everything together, and I can't tell you where we're going to see those things fall out yet. But we are addressing both the Medicaid and what we will call the pre-Medicaid population. And I think that's really important that we look at how we deliver services to our Medicaid-eligible population, but also what the state can be doing in the pre-Medicaid population and folks that are moving into challenges in their life but may be able to better design some ways to live out the latter part of their life without necessarily becoming eligible for the Medicaid assistance. So in the additional Medicaid capacity and access, we'll take some looks at rate restructuring. You know that we also, in the 07 session, increased the rates for assisted living facilities, adult foster care, and residential care, what I call that mid-level care. And then as part of that package, there was going to be another look at how those amounts are delivered to the facilities. They've been on like a 5 or 6 step level of care kinds of needs, and they're looking at limiting that, kind of raising the baseline, but not making people be reevaluated quite so many times. And so there's some continued work around rate restructuring, and the industry is still staying right in there, reducing some of the decisions to move out of the Medicaid market, and we'll get more updates on that as we go along. There's also some workload and staffing studies proposed and taking place, and looking at ways to increase in-home care access. In the package of non-Medicaid supports that are sometimes referred to as pre-spend down, before you spend your nest egg and get to the level of need, OPI modernization, or Oregon Project Independence Modernization, is very much a part of that, and I want to reassure everyone that that's right up there on the top of the list. There are several factors. One is that we don't have general fund going into OPI right now. We've moved that to the property tax deferral program, and the revenues in that program are decreasing, and we're going to see a gap in the ability to deliver services, let alone any increase in service. So that one is getting a lot of attention, along with the Aging and Disabilities Resource Connections, being referred to as ADRC. And I look at it rather simplistically as sort of an information and referral service, but really the picture that I would paint is that moment in time when an individual or the family comes up against a crisis point, and either an accident or all of a sudden the realization hits that mom or dad just can't keep going on the way they have. Maybe there are resources in the family, but I can tell you when there's a hospitalization or a kind of an urgent need, it sort of just hits you across the face and you don't know where to turn. So if we can better establish a system of a human being that one could call, not dependent on resources, and kind of get some help and direction, I think that we could help people make wiser choices in the long run that they might well be happier with than necessarily direct to an admittance to a nursing home or something of that nature. Part of that whole system of supports is also the restructuring or restoration of general assistance. And I'm going to kind of move that out of my world and into Representative Kotex. And also what's referred to as equity for our AAAs or our senior services program. It's kind of a complex formula, but it gets to the way the entities are funded and the fact that they haven't been in line for cost of living increases, and so they're slipping a little farther and farther behind in their ability to deliver service, and it's an area that we need to take some serious looks at. We're also talking about mental health and addiction services to older Americans, and a lot of attention to quality workforce development kinds of issues, both the staffing, recruitment, retention, ensuring quality of adequate training, strengthening the family caregiver support. All of those that we put in that kind of long list are still part of the discussion, and I'm really excited. I really think that we'll be able to bring forward a package that will make a real difference to Oregonians, as well as talking about livable communities for vulnerable Oregonians, protecting elders and other vulnerable adults. Some of that is still kind of being developed, and I know that others will be part of that. So I don't have detail on it at this point. And finally, I guess, as a recognition of looking at special needs transportation, affordable housing, volunteer supports, are some things that are certainly going to take cooperation of many other groups. We can't do this all in one package, but all of those are pieces that we need to put into our perspective as we talk about it. And then I think it's also important for everyone to remember that we can't solve everything in one biennium, that we really are trying to look long-term and collectively at a plan that will get us to a point of restoring, restructuring, and stabilizing our quality system of long-term care over the next two or three biennium. So if you have any specific questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but that's just an update of where we are right now.
Carol, thank you for a nice little presentation.
There's a whole lot of stuff in a real short time, but I'm hungry too.
You mentioned the property tax deferral, and that it's actually causing the dollars to dwindle from the OPI fund. I mean, we removed $4 million from OPI during the second session. Does that have some impact? Having been on the Revenue Committee and having been part of the structuring of developing something for the property tax deferral to take some amount from OPI to help seniors to pay for back taxes through their tax assessors and everything from the counties, because they're the ones that really came to us and represent them. Gelser and I were on the Revenue Committee, and that was an issue that we were dealing with and tried to kind of find some common ground for them. This was a solution that we had come up with. But in the process, I mean, we lost $4 million. Mm-hmm. So I guess my point being is that that's not what we had counted on, you know, initially. So I would surely think that that had some impact for what your comment was, you know, that it's causing dollars to dwindle from OPI. So if we beat OPI up, bottom line, I mean, should be back on track.
And I think that's what we're wrestling with, are the numbers that it will take to maintain current service level in the OPI programming, and then what it would take to enhance that. The cautionary note that I need to throw into this is it's really important to look at all of what we're trying to do in a comprehensive manner, because it's too easy to say, if we put more money into OPI, we solve the problem for seniors. And Oregon Project Independence is a tremendous project that does a great deal for providing some assistance to people and helping them stay in their homes a little longer. But the reality of the aging process, whether I like it or not, is that it tends to be progressive. And while it's everyone's goal, I think, or at least most people's goal, to stay in their own homes, hopefully to the end of their life, that's not always reality. And what I like to say is that it can't be, shouldn't be, should never be considered failure if one's needs progress to the point where they need to have some other level of assistance beyond staying in their own home. So that's why I keep focusing on the package and making sure that we have service delivery across the spectrum. But I've never been on the revenue committee, and I'm not totally articulate in all this, although I was asked to attend the revenue committee last week so that we could just kind of talk about some of the things that we're trying to do to address the issues that were being raised there. And I know that that is all part of the piece, that we need to look at general fund going into Oregon Project Independence, as well as some of the work that was done with that particular tax deferral program.
Can I just add on to that? I think what I'm hearing you say is the money was taken out of the project. So if it were put back in, would it be helpful?
Initially, that's what hopefully I was designed to be, was to be eventually to be self-sufficient when it was all structured.
$4 million going back in is not going to make it self-sufficient, though. That was what I was answering that specific question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think Representative Cowan partially answered my question, because I do think the challenge with the funding stream for the Oregon Project Independence is because of what was set up in the 2005 session as a funding mechanism. And part of what your group was looking at is like looking at a more sustainable way to deal with that. I mean, I don't recall taking $4 million program just in addressing the revenue stream. So I mean, that's my recollection.
And that's the reason I'm trying not to isolate it to any one piece, because I think it really is time to step back and look at what are the needs of the program to make it address as much of the need out there as possible, and what are the appropriate sources of funding for that.
Thank you, Manager. I follow up really to what Representative Kotek was saying. I want to be very careful in this committee that we're not institutionalizing the idea that we somehow took $4 million out of Oregon Project Independence last session, because that simply isn't true. There was a shift in the funding stream that was set up in 2005. There was a difference between the governor's recommended budget and what the legislature allocated, but that's very different than reducing that number. But more importantly, I wanted to tag on to what you were saying. I think it's so important, and I know that this committee is right on board with this. We have so many needs for our senior and people with disability population in the state of Oregon. And I think sometimes in the general public, because these programs are so complicated, it becomes very easy just to boil it down to Oregon Project Independence. And as leaders, particularly in the human services arena, I think it's so important for us to be talking with the public and people in our communities about the comprehensive nature of services that we need. Because there's too many people that think they can say, I support Project Independence, and therefore I'm supporting a healthy future for seniors, when the questions are much more complex. The issue of reimbursement rates for assisted living facilities, for home care, all of these other issues really are even more pressing than that very small piece of our long-term care system. And I really applaud the leadership that Representative Cowan has shown in helping us to understand the comprehensive nature of that system, how complicated the issue of supporting seniors in a wide variety of service modes is. And I really appreciate the work of the stakeholders in helping us to look at that. And I hope we can make sure that we don't boil senior services down to Oregon Project Independence. It's an important part, but it's a small part. The bigger picture is where we really need to be going, and we can't make OPI a political football, because it's going to undermine our efforts to help seniors.
Okay, I just don't want to start.
Okay, if I could just respond generically, I don't want to get into that specific piece either, but it is that comprehensive nature that the group has remained committed to. And I think it's really important to sort of look at the spectrum of the generically called stakeholders group. There is a coalition for Oregon seniors and people with physical disabilities who are working very hard. It runs the gamut, and if I start listing people, I'll leave somebody off, and then somebody will be shooting darts at my back. But it runs the gamut from industry who has a goal of supplying places for people to live and keeping people in those, to senior service agencies, our AAAs, our O4AD group, who are working to find appropriate services for individuals as their needs, to groups like AARP, who generally represent the whole spectrum of seniors. There are really very different interests at the table in this conversation. So the fact that everybody remains together and remains committed to the conversation and to keeping this a comprehensive look at the needs of people who are aging and aging into their disabilities in our state, I think that's really important. People jokingly tell me I'm trying to herd cats, but so far all my cats are still all there around the table, and I'm very appreciative of that. So.
That's great. Thanks for all the work. Thank you. I've kept you apprised of that, and I know it's a hard work for you and all the people.
It's my passion, and it's a labor of love on my part.
That's
so
great. And we look forward to possibly some legislation coming from the committee.
That would be my expectation. As we sort this out, some of it will be in the budget process, and I'm sure there will be pieces that will end up in hopefully a kind of a comprehensive piece of legislation for this committee so that we can sort of stay focused on that collective need.
Good. Thank you. All right, colleagues. Now, so now I think I told all of you I wanted, of course, the committee to entertain suggestions for committee bills. And I know that Representative Olson has an idea. And I'm not sure that we put out enough copies for anybody. And we're not going to debate these. We're going to be just presenting these ideas. And we'll have another meeting where we can vote on whether or not we want to present these as committee bills.
Yes.
And I don't have my calendar on, but we're scheduled for these four more meetings. We are scheduled for one, and we may, if I can convince leadership that we need two, we may have two, but I wouldn't count on that.
So, Madam Chair, thank you, and colleagues here. If you recall, last year, the 07 House Bill 35.4 was dealt with the issue of mental health and law enforcement statuses. And we traveled to Albany and then listened to testimony down there. Well, it passed. We actually kind of modified it and everything to do a work group study, that type thing, and that passed out of the House 456 to give you some history of it and kind of refresh your memories on it. But since that time period, I have met three different occasions with a number of folks down there out of Albany that are involved with mental health issues, as well as the law enforcement community. And we're getting closer, wanting to try to make it as simple as possible, but clearly to make it voluntary, because that was something that we'd heard, that was a possibility that it could work. And Frank Moore, who is the director of the Linn County Mental Health, folks down there in Albany has been deeply involved with this as well. So this is just kind of the nuts and bolts of it, and this is something that I would love to have you take a look at and possibly even consider doing as a committee.
Terrific. And if we do consider this as a committee bill or any other concepts that you and I come up with, we won't have a debate about it in the committee. We will send it on. And then at the hearing, then we would have a debate.
Okay. And if, for example, if you raise this to the legislative council for drafting, make sure that they, if you want to connect the committee, they can do so to me, they won't even be able to make a copy of the council, but give me a copy. Or if you haven't, if you want to submit it, let me know.
Is it easier? Because I was wondering about that in terms of if they know it's a potential committee bill.
As long as you've got my name on there, like contract or just a note for the okay, at least if everything is lost.
So then it goes from you to the committee?
Then, yeah. Then if you do this to me, then I will just carte blanche send it to the committee and public document.
Okay. So, any others?
Well, as I mentioned before, I will be presenting a committee bill regarding the adoption and standing of the foster families that go from 6 months to a year. So I'll be working on that. Three of us and Representative Widnes went to Harvard earlier this summer, and we met with their early childhood development program. And one of the things that we talked about was maternal depression. And I've called together a group of people who were involved in this issue here in the state. And so we may be coming up with some legislation, and if so, I would like the committee to look at that as a committee bill. It may be only at this point, because it's sort of new in the process, it may be that we'll want to set up a committee to look at this or something to that effect. We probably aren't ready in this legislative session to have the funding that will be provided. But at least I think it's an important issue that the state needs to be looking at.
Are there other states or
Yes. Yes. Illinois is doing it. I'll give you a That's called
postpartum.
There may be another reason.
Right. So any other bills that anybody would like us to consider for a committee day? Yes.
At the last meeting in Clackamas County building, the committee had discussion about the parents and scholars and the tuition that they pay and the possibility of some sort of tuition break for parents. Is that something you want to do?
Yes. Yes.
There is possibly a housekeeping bill with regard to the existing statutory language around parents and scholars. That now that we're implementing the program might have to be addressed. But in terms of, can I get back to you?
Yes.
I guess I was waiting. I haven't had a chance to check the department and worry about that. But there were some things that have come up as we address implementation that we want to make sure we fix. Especially it's good to have that. So I will. I'll get back to you.
Sorry.
Okay. What is your timeline on it?
Okay.
Next time you can do it. Because I got your message.
Okay.
Probably for getting things to legislative council. We will, of course, would want it enough from the last meeting to get it out. So,
soon as that.
Probably a little bit sooner. We're going to start getting backed up.
Yeah. Okay. We, as I said, we will have one more meeting, at least one more meeting. If we need another one, I can talk to leadership about doing that. But we'll have other issues. Follow-up and communication. Janice, I think it's important. And if there are any other things that you'd like to put on the agenda, please let me know.
Yeah, I think next month is when that probably law report is. I met with Department of Justice yesterday. They finished the data. And there are a large group of folks, the assessment centers, there's medical directors, Department of Justice, Department of Human Services. It might take a little
bit. I would hope that there was nobody here who was left who thought they were going to be able to testify. We did not. We just asked for invited testimony. So nobody is saying yes, they're here to testify.
That's a good thing.
All right. Thank you so much, committee. And I will close the committee on human services and women's wellness.